You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate.
Yeah, well, I've seen some things too, Roy Batty, like Porky's, probably 12 times.
Any sea beams glittering in Porky's, Adam?
No sea beams, Josh, only lots of G-strings.
It has been 35 years since Rutger Hauer's Roy Batty uttered those immortal lines. And yes, 35 years since Porky's. In anticipation of the Blade Runner sequel coming in October, we've got a Sacred Cow review of the Ridley Scott original, plus our top five films of 1982.
The Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips joins us for all that and more.
Did you really see Porky's 12 times?
Ahead on Film Spotting. You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh, Adam, and from the Chicago Tribune, Michael Phillips. Welcome back to Film Spotting, Michael.
Thank you, man.
Hey, Michael.
How are you doing?
It's great to have you here. We're going back 35 years to 1982, a Sacred Cow review of Blade Runner and our top five movies of that year. Michael, paint us a picture of Michael Phillips circa 1982. Is this pre-beard? Did you come out with the beard?
There was never a pre-beard period for me. Although I did try to grow a beard the first year back from college, and when I came home, it was literally pointing and laughing all over Racine, Wisconsin, because it just came in and sort of thing-like patches, you know. It looked like The Thing, the Carpenter movie.
Okay, we'll get there.
With a beard. It was like The Thing with an attempt at a beard. And then a couple years later, I never got rid of it after that.
It sounds
once
like
you
the
perfected
most,
it, yeah, you stuck with it.
I stuck with it.
The most disturbing monster I've ever heard of is what you're describing.
It's certainly the scariest thing Racine's ever seen.
Well, hopefully we'll get to a few more Michael Phillips stories and more embarrassing ones at that as we do get into that list of our favorite films of 82. More on that year, the year of E.T., of Rocky III, and yes, Porky's, later in the show.
But first, our Sacred Cow review of the 1982 movie that decreed henceforth and forevermore every sci-fi dystopia must feature neon and endless rain. It's Ridley Scott's Blade Runner.
They jumped the shuttle off-world, killed the crew and passengers. We found the shuttle drifting off the coast 2 weeks ago, so we know they're around.
Embarrassing.
No, sir, not embarrassing, because no one's ever going to find out they're down here. That you're going to spot them and you're going to air them out.
I don't work here anymore. Give it to Holden. He's good.
I did. He can breathe okay, as long as nobody unplugs him. It's not good enough. Not good as you. I need you, Dex. This is a bad one. The worst yet. I need the old Blade Runner. I need your magic.
The film Blade Runner survives in several different versions and point-by-point, replicant-by-replicant comparisons between the eight cuts, most of which are actually available today, They've fueled many a Comic-Con conversation and countless film nerd arguments since the first version was released to mainstream bafflement and disappointing box office figures back in June 1982, when I was 21 years old. That same day, in June, John Carpenter's remake of The Thing came out, too, and both those films have grown in stature over the years. That's kind of an obvious point, but it's true. And you can find plenty of fans who would pick either The Thing or Blade Runner, very different brands of science fiction, as their number one film of that year, 1982, whether they were born then or not. Blade Runner comes from the Philip K. Dick story, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And even those who didn't care much about the film version, directed by Ridley Scott, they had to acknowledge the density and fascination of the visual quality of the film, the production design, the effects, and the overall atmosphere. This was Los Angeles in the year 2019. Perpetual rain falling, miserable crowding, huge looming video billboards that, well, actually did come to pass more or less by 2017, more so than the flying cars. Blade Runner Deckard, played by Harrison Ford, who may or may not be a replicant himself, depending on the version of the film you're watching, chases down four rogue replicants targeted for elimination, but he meets a formidable match in Rutger Hauer's ubermensch of a lemon-haired god. So, when I saw the film at 21, guys, you weren't even born yet, I know, I came out wildly conflicted, but was very eager to see it a second time very soon, to really see it, see all of it, or at least more of it. Two questions I have for you. One, did Blade Runner flop back in 82 because George Lucas had reoriented the mass audience's taste for retro futuristic science fiction so radically 5 years earlier with Star Wars? And two, is Blade Runner a movie for you today that was simply ahead of its time and now seems very much what Ridley Scott intended it to be, an L.A. story with legs longer than Joanna Cassidy's? So I wanted to end on that sleazy note.
Thank you. Yeah, appreciate that. I think you're right. Why Blade Runner was probably initially rejected. You put this side by side with something like Star Wars, and it's absolutely a different experience. Contemplative. Right. I was relieved, though, that it wasn't overbearing in that way. My memory of it, having seen probably the original theatrical release later in the 80s, I would have come across it, is what I initially watched. And my memory was that it was more ponderous, more existential on the surface in the way, oh, I don't know, Prometheus is now, or even Alien Covenant a little
covering
bit.
Covering similar ground.
Yes, it is.
You're actually promulgating the auteur theory.
Well, but I think that in comparison to those films in particular, it wears those elements lightly. Hmm. In comparison to Star Wars, it wears them heavily. So
right, okay,
that's probably a reason. I really did enjoy it this time. For the record, watched the final cut. Looked amazing, mm-hmm. The Blu-ray. I mean, the first thing we need to say, and you touched on it, Michael, is the visual aesthetic of this film. This thing could have been made yesterday, especially if you're watching it on a decent screen on Blu-ray. It just holds up absolutely from the flying cars to the – here's the world-building detail that jumped out at me this time. That's just a small thing, but you multiply this, you know, 50 times and you get a full world. The handles of the umbrellas, how they glow, fluorescent.
Huh.
And you add enough of those and you get this parade of bobbing, glowing sticks down the street. It's just something like that in terms of prop design, mm-hmm. production design – that really fills out this world. And I think that's why the movie has been so influential and has lingered, because it set that vision for so many people. Mm. And I think also because it's the definitive sci-noir. I mean, this is a merging of those two genres, science fiction and film noir. I think, and maybe we can get into this, that's mm-hmm. absolutely the movie's strength in some ways. But it's also – there are areas to this where if you're holding it up as a film noir, it does fall – teeny bit short for mm-hmm. me, but absolutely loved this revisit. Spoiler, it makes my top five films of 1982. Now the big question that's going to be harder for me is, do I prefer this or Ridley Scott's Alien? Because I think that's one we've bandied about on the show here, Adam, and have always said, well, it would really take a revisit of Blade Runner to answer that.
Yeah.
Now we kind of have to, and I don't have an answer right now.
They're both excellent films.
I think you've hit on another reason why the mainstream audience back in 82 was just sort of perplexed and a little bit turned off by Blade Runner, because they had just, you know, the last thing they remember with that and that brand name on it, Ridley Scott, was Alien, which really, you know, grabbed people by the throat.
Much more pure genre.
Absolutely. And the sci-noir handle, I like that. And really only Spielberg's Minority Report would sort of compete maybe with more recent work in that same genre.
Yeah. No, I want to echo a lot of what you said there, Josh, including the stuff about its noir influence. But first, the cinematography, Jordan Cronenweth, we'll talk about that a little bit, the art direction. Yeah, the visual look of the film is still incredibly stunning. And I'm thinking of this, too, a little bit, not just in the context of something like Star Wars, but we did a while back here on the show a 70s sci-fi marathon, and we covered a lot of movies that were made in the early part of that decade that are kind of silly now, though I wouldn't say The Andromeda Strain is necessarily silly, and I like that movie, but maybe something like Silent Running looks pretty quaint and cheesy from the 2017 perspective. But some of the stuff made in the mid to later part of that decade too, Logan's Run,
right?
They feel way more than 5 or 6 years apart. They feel generations apart from a filmmaking standpoint. And it's almost as if this future dystopia had really never existed before Blade Runner. I feel like it has been the influence for every film that has followed it. And one of the things that really stood out to me was the sense watching it that it's terrifying. It does feel like a dystopia very much at times in terms of the overcrowding. We are clued into the fact that if you want to get away, and most people do, they go off-world, right? That these are kind of the nobodies. And even the detective or the cop, Bryant, at one point says that to him, if you're not a cop, you're one of the little people. Well, this is a world full of little people, of leave-behinds, who really have kind of no future. So it's a scary place at times and terrifying, but it's also just because of the look of it, exciting and alluring and somehow inviting, like you almost want to go and experience this version of Los Angeles.
And you believe what you're looking at. And in a funny way, without any of the corny taglines like what we were affixed to Superman, a very different, you know, science fiction fantasy a few years earlier, you know, you can believe in what you're watching a lot because the film takes place at night and it's raining and it's got the right texture and background that the kind of effects that Scott was working with and his team, they're pulled off. You don't see any of the usual blues, you know, lines around. Mm-hmm. A little bit here and there, but it just has a believability that other. Now, does it connect? Does it satisfy on story terms? That's what, you know, back in 82, audiences were kind of like, it's not an untrackable plot. It's a very simple plot.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply, okay, you know, one relatably, you know, kind of worn down private eye type figure, you know, in this case a Blade Runner, has to chase down, you know, one by one these targets, mm-hmm. these replicants. The film's got a very kind of vignette structure, and that's unusual, you know, especially coming off year before you had the second Star Wars film, Empire Strikes Back, you know, of course the main Star Wars film, 77. You know, that kind of pacing for the time was just pure Atari, right? Whoosh, you know, like fast, and you didn't get mm-hmm. a sense of like even segments or big scenes. It was just all one ride, right?
Mm-hmm.
Blade Runner, very different. And I think, Josh, even if you didn't experience it as ponderous or heavy, at the time, I think it was disorienting, you know.
Sure. And you know, as far as the story beats go, you can even sense in the final cut, which is, you know, Scott's preferred version, that things are still being a bit patched together in terms of Ford's identity, Deckard's identity,
mm-hmm.
his relationship with the Sean Young character. And even here, there's the one glimpse of the unicorn, right? The one dream sequence. And you somewhat know how to fit that in if you have familiarity with the lore about all these other versions. But seeing that just on its own, it stands out. So you can tell that there are pieces trying to be forced together here narratively. And I think that does provide a little bit of a hiccup. But again, it's more of a mood that this movie is managing to evoke. It's that fatalism from film noir
mm-hmm.
that it really latches onto and makes us feel. Of course, you have things like we've mentioned the floating billboard that has spotlights that are constantly streaming through all the windows. And all the windows have Venetian blinds, right? In 2019 Los Angeles. Yeah. So you get this noir sense. You get Harrison Ford, you know, I was a little disappointed him being a hero of my youth from all these other films, you know, Indiana Jones and Han Solo. Here he's just a harder drinking Indiana Jones, a little crabbier, otherwise tries to float by on the same charisma. He's no Sam Spade, in other words.
He's so disaffected.
He's fine, well, yeah, he's fine, but you could tell he's working against that charm that he brought to those other parts purposefully. You can see why he was drawn to this. You know, I'm going to make my anti-Star Wars in a way. But I think that still makes for a somewhat less interesting character. The movie really, for me, belongs to Rutger Hauer. And,
yeah.
And this is where the fatalism comes in. This is where this movie becomes about mortality.
Yeah.
And the replicants just stand in for us. They have this four-year lifespan. And Roy Batty, the way he has a dreaminess, he's in wonder at the world, even as he despises his corporate creators mm-hmm. who have given him this four-year lifespan. And the way
that's
Hauer
how it works
balances—
I should say that's how it works at the Trib, too. It's just a four-year renewal.
I was going to say, you've been renewed a couple of times. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
The way Hauer balances those two things, though, where there's this poet inside him,
yes.
inside this assassin, and he recognizes his mortality, and the way that reflects on all of us gives Blade Runner, despite any plot confusion, this heavy sort of noir fatalism that I think sticks with
you. Yeah, I might argue with you on that. I think that, to me, that is where the eye rolling I do experience, and I know this is sacrilege for the Blade Runner fans out there, but I am a fan. I mean, I saw it twice back then, and I've certainly seen it twice or three times since. But
Tears and Rain doesn't work for you?
Well, I do enough of my own. I don't need to. But I think other things about that movie, you know, really do point to everything Ridley Scott explored over and over with, you know, the alien sort of world of the more recent films. He loves this idea of you know, life as it is lived or imagined by non-human, you know, creations. Mm-hmm. And it's a great theme, you know, and it gets right to the kind of, you know, everything from, you know, there's a lot of movies and novels right next door to this idea. And I think it's the point of this movie, but there is something a little dead about the Harrison Ford character. He's reactive.
Yeah.
He's sullen. There's mm-hmm. just not – there's no heroics, you know, all that. And all this Harrison Ford knew going in, he wasn't yet an interesting enough actor to play two notes at once within that range.
Yeah, he's coasting on his charisma here a little bit.
Remember when you were six? You and your brother snuck into an empty building through a basement window. You were going to play doctor. He showed you his. When it got to be your turn, you chickened and ran. Remember that? You ever tell anybody that? Your mother, Tyrell, anybody? Huh? You remember the spider that lived in a bush outside your window? Orange body, green legs. Watched her build a web all summer. Then one day there's a big egg in it.
The egg hatched.
The egg hatched?
And?
And 100 baby spiders came out. And they ate her.
Implants. Those aren't your memories. They're somebody else's. They're Tyrell's nieces.
I am a big fan of the villain performances here. I would include actually even Pris, Daryl Hannah,
yes,
in the mix
right.
here.
That's a really good scene.
I think William Sanderson is the actor who plays J.F. Sebastian, who
Tragic.
Sees them, and when he sees Roy Batty come in, he knows for sure, if he didn't know already, that both of them are replicants, and he says, you're just so perfect. And they are. There's something about them that instantly suggests that. But I'm with you, Josh, in terms of loving the Hauer character and performance, and I love that he is this character. He's built up as a bad guy. Bryant calls him the worst, and he's a menacing figure, and we are supposed to be afraid of him a little bit, I think, but he gets scared, which we don't see a lot from villains in these types of sci-fi movies. Mm. He gets emotional, and I do think that end soliloquy is still, for me, one of the most tragic and moving soliloquies in all of cinema, this idea that he's lamenting memories and locations and visions that are completely made up. They are meaningless to any human being listening to what he is describing. And yet the way he does it, the fact
yeah.
that he is so poetic about it and so evocative in his delivery, it makes it such a lament that you feel the power of that. So I do love that performance. And look, what I responded to when I saw this movie for the first time, and honestly, the last time, it was back in college. It was over 20 years ago I saw this film. But that question, of course, that typical sort of cliche, if you will, sci-fi question, what ultimately makes us human? And of course, the movie suggests that beyond emotions, beyond a capacity for imagination, maybe it is memories. And beyond memories, it's this instinct for survival, the desire to live, to go beyond your life expectancy, however you pull that off. And so we get into that that similar ground to some of the Alien movies with Scott, where he loves the idea of meeting your maker,
right,
confronting your maker and asking for more life or demanding more life, which is something I think we would all probably do if we could. It is a fundamentally human quest.
Yeah.
One of the things I missed, though, that really stuck out to me this time watching it that fits in with all of this is the end of the film, that showdown between Batty and Deckard. I always saw as Batty just kind of toying with Deckard, maybe ultimately having sympathy for him. He spares him, of course, but toying with him, but just kind of prolonging their confrontation, that he is ultimately going to take him down. Whether he changes his mind or not is something we can discuss. But I thought maybe, okay, he has a cruel streak in him and he's going to take it out on Deckard, who has killed his friends, the other replicants. And then what I really tapped into this time is the way Scott emphasizes Deckard's struggle to survive, really keying in on the lengths he goes to in order to survive, climbing through those holes, climbing up on that bureau, whatever it is, going through the ceiling, going out on that ledge, the way he's hanging on for dear life, literally,
right,
and his fingers are about to fall. And we are constantly seeing that from Batty's perspective, too. I think in a lot of ways, it's a more intense and shortened version of the entire struggle of Batty and his replicants since they had their mutiny and escaped. It's basically, I think what he sees in him in that moment is that same desire to live, that same desire to survive that he himself feels.
Mm-hmm.
And so ultimately then sees a certain kinship with him.
And yeah, there's a vulnerability there too.
Mm-hmm.
I think, so this is what Ford does have, and this is what he had from the start. It's the same thing that Bruce Willis tapped into that made him an iconic action hero, was vulnerability. This guy could get hurt. You know, he wasn't like Stallone or he wasn't like Schwarzenegger in this way. And we see that in Ford's performance here. I think it works really well. And I think what's so moving about that climactic showdown is that Batty just succumbs to his own exhaustion and weariness and maybe realizes the futility of this human emotion he's experiencing,
mm-hmm,
revenge. Does that make him human, that he now wants to pursue vengeance for Deckard killing the other replicants? I don't know, maybe. And the speech itself works for me because it's almost as if Batty had been programmed for Shakespeare. It's that dramatically given, right?
Yeah,
that's why we remember it. It's very melodramatic. But
he's theatrical.
He's theatrical.
He makes entrances.
But underneath that, you can sense that there's something also deeply felt about what he's saying that Howard is also bringing to the performance. And I think that's where the connection is made, where then we start to realize, okay, this whole movie is about our own mortality, whether we're replicants or not. Maybe that's where it has a leg up on, I can see what you're saying, Michael, Alien. You could say
it's a totally
Alien did
different.
This,
it's a different
right, but
kind of
in
thing,
terms
yeah.
of the artificially intelligent figure, you could say, well, Alien did this with one side character, you know, in Ash. Everything that Blade Runner is doing, Alien did kind of off to the side. To a degree, I see that, but I think there's something larger and more universal about this sense of mortality that we're experiencing in Blade Runner that we don't maybe get in the character of Ash.
Now, does it matter? Alien. Does it matter to you guys? The key question that everybody keeps coming back to is Deckard a replicant?
So I want to talk about that for sure. I don't know if I'm ready to get there yet, but I think we should close with that for sure. I want to go back to something you both brought up in terms of the narrative and how successful or unsuccessful it is, because one of the co-screenwriters here, David Peoples, I saw a comment from him where he said, I think fairly recently, that if you're talking about Ridley Scott and you have to choose visuals over narrative, and I'm paraphrasing here, he says, you always go with visuals. But damn, I wish it had a better narrative, people said. So basically commenting
okay.
on
See?
His own material that Scott
and
envisioned
this is
on screen.
This is, I think, a limitation
so
of the film.
So you guys touch on this a little bit. I wondered if there were any more specifics about what specifically with the story didn't work. What I would single out does go back to what you were talking about, Josh, in terms of the Sean Young character. And I love her performance. And of course, part of what I love about her performance is the way Cronenworth lights her. And the fact that every time she walks into a room and the way she walks in and out of shadows, you are just mesmerized by her. And it is down to her movement itself is also fascinating. But, oh, that sex scene.
Will you kiss her?
I can't rely on
you. Say you kiss me.
The ramifications of it, everything that would go with this character Deckard, who we can talk about the replicant part of this later, but a human, we perceive him to be, we believe he perceives himself to be, about to engage in this act with a replicant, the movie takes no time to really think about any of the consequences of that whatsoever. And I think that the whole thing is so bizarre that there is a noir inevitability. From the moment she walks in, she's a mall, and they seem to be drawn to each other in some way. I'll give the movie that. But when it happens, it still feels like the movie hasn't completely earned that relationship between them. And I think you can even point to something like the fact that she plays a major role in the plot when she saves his life, pulling out a gun randomly on the street and killing a replicant who's trying to kill Harrison Ford. Where does that come from other than it's serving a plot need?
Right, right.
I think that's absolutely true. Yeah.
And I also think here's where the noir comparisons don't do the movie any favors, because a strength of all the classic film noirs is the femme fatale. And Young, I wouldn't, you know, I don't think it's that arresting of a performance, but I think that's because of the script, Adam, not because of anything Young is doing. Certainly she is lit in that way. They set her up to be that femme fatale, but they have not written her that way. The scene you talked about, the sex scene, rape scene, almost is how it plays now. I mean, it's really disturbing when you watch the scene through today's eyes, maybe, that 1982 audiences might not have. But I think it's also just troubling because the character is never fully developed, and it's a crucial character, right? Rachel should be the linchpin between the replicant world and the human world, and she's not given enough narrative support
to make
that
work. I think she captures that otherworldliness.
I would argue with – I think both those performances, it's not that they were – spring chickens. I mean, they had, you know, they had done some work by then, Ford and Young. But I think those performances are not quite what they could be, even given that script. I think craftier, wittier performers, not necessarily playing for laughs or anything. God knows I wouldn't. You know, that film can only accommodate so much levity at all. But I think craftier performers would play that guessing game a little more about how human or how replicant we really are in different degrees with these two characters. But I think, again, I get the sense of kind of one note hit hard. I don't know if Ridley Scott's even really an actor's director, frankly. And I think Young, you know, I think he could get 100 actresses in Hollywood who probably would have pulled it off more so than Young.
Wow.
Yeah, medium talent at best, I think. Now, Ford, obviously, better than that on his high end. He wasn't there yet with this. And I think that's a limitation of the film. I think also just the storytelling rhythm, even if it's a simple, going to do this, going to do this, going to do this, and then I'm going to, you know, meet my Waterloo maybe at the end. That's a very methodical, segmented, vignette-oriented kind of structure. And I think that's probably why the screenwriter, David Peoples, the co-writer, was a little frustrated, because it just is what it is. It's not much, you know. And you get all this setup, and one of my favorite scenes is the one with Joanna Cassidy as the snake handler, you know, in the window. Yeah. And she's, you know, that's a performer who is completely alive. I mean, she's a great actress anyway, and I wish she had gotten the role she deserved at the, you know, in her heyday. But that, you know, that obviously that replicant's life story is over 5 minutes later. After this sort of like baroquely sadistic series of, you know, running through the plate glass windows, which is like, that was even in the history of plate glass being smashed on film, that was a ton of plate glass.
It was.
And it's a bit, that's, to me, that moment is kind of, it's perfect. It's a perfect, you know, emblem of what Ridley Scott's up to. It's gorgeous, and it's unsettling, and it might be a tiny bit much. and that's Ridley Scott, you know, whether you love him or not.
I have to say, I did get really caught up in that question of whether or not Deckard is a replicant. And one of my questions to you guys is, why does it matter, really? Why is it that some people refuse at this point to accept it? What is it about the film or those characters or us as movie watchers that want to cling to some notion that he isn't? But before we get there, let's go ahead and try to answer the question, because like I said, it is something that I've been thinking about since I finished the film. Where do you guys come out?
Well, I'd have to separate. What would you say if you had just watched, say, the final cut? I mean, is there enough there that we'd even be asking the question? I think that one sequence of the unicorn is maybe the biggest hint, especially after we've learned that memories have been implanted. He seems confused at where that has come from.
Yeah.
And that may be just enough for you to say, oh, okay, in addition to the Rachel character, who is already been someone who's deluded to think they're real. So maybe you could surmise it, but honestly, just having watched the final cut, I think it's just a tantalizing possibility.
Well, I did want to scan to this scene before I sat down here, and I failed to do so in the original theatrical cut. But I think there's one other giveaway even before the unicorn. I think there are some other hints and clues potentially along the way. And yes, I only watched the final cut this time, but there is a hint that Ridley Scott puts in there that I assume is in the theatrical version originally, which is a question. She openly brings it up, right? She raises it to him in his apartment. She says, "Have you taken the test? Are you sure you want to?"
Yeah, that's true.
So it puts that in our minds, at least as viewers. Does. He doesn't hear it because he falls asleep. I think there are some other things that you could cling to if you were looking for the support. The way Bryant refers to him as a one-man slaughterhouse. The fact that he does seem to have such a non-life, almost like a replicant might. And he seems almost like he was programmed to do this job and do only that job, and he doesn't have the sense of empathy. There's a vulnerability and an emotion to someone like Roy Batty, but he has no problem hurting anyone along the way to get to what he ultimately wants. Deckard is very much the same way. Yes. I was even thinking about some of the dialogue where there is that line I reference where Bryant says about Batty, "There is a bad one. He's the worst." He says to Deckard later, "Aren't you the good one?" And it makes me think almost, I wonder if it's playing with the idea whether Batty knows something, or Ridley Scott, again, is just sort of toying with us, the idea that, well, he's the good replicant who's serving the people. So anyway, that's there. There is a clue, I think, in the photographs on his piano. Mm-hmm. Remember, we see that. And we do learn earlier that the replicants, they love those photos. They cling to those. They're given those as memories of a supposed real past. So that's all there. And then we, of course, get to the unicorn. And I want to talk about that and the origami leave behind. Edward James Olmos, right? At the end of the film. That would seem to be pretty strong evidence, right? That this must be a case where he's a replicant because it is referencing his daydream. As you said, the unicorn earlier, which ties back to Rachel and the clip we heard and Harrison Ford informing her, "No, you're really a replicant because that might have been Tyrell's nieces. Those were implanted in you." And it's as if Gaff, the Edward James Olmos character, is saying, "I've read your file just like you read hers. That was just an implant, that unicorn. That's why he made a unicorn there." So that would seem to clinch it, right? That he must be a replicant, or that Ridley Scott is absolutely trying to say that he is.
But is the movie better for it?
No, I don't know. So we'll get there. Let me just finish my spiel here on whether or not he is. Because you can counter that and say, in the original version, we don't get the unicorn daydream, right? We do get the origami figure at the end. And all it conveys is nothing more than Gaff basically showing, "I was there, I could have killed her, and I didn't." And that's how we all saw the first version of this film, and that was enough.
Or I'm on your tail.
Or that too. I certainly read it as, he was here, he had his chance to take her down, he's letting them get away. Deckard seems to realize that. And he kind of reacts nonchalantly. It's not as if Deckard reacts to that as if he's been stunned by some existential realization that he's a replicant. He sort of turns and with some urgency heads out the door with her. So this is all leading to the fact that I think the more emphatic giveaway is that goldish red glow that only the replicants have in their eyes. Hmm. If you watch the whole film, only the artificial figures have that glow in their eyes. And damn it, Deckard has it in the scene back at the apartment where he's standing right next to her, kind of behind her shoulder. And she has it in her eyes and he has it in her eyes. And why would that be there?
Adam, that's the look of love.
I mean, it does beg the question, why do we only see it that once in him?
Right.
But why would he have that if he wasn't artificial?
Right. And it does come and go for her as well, I believe.
Yeah, it's not there all the time.
Nobody questions whether or not Sean Young is a replicant at all.
They know. I mean,
they
the don't.
First line,
you know it right away.
Do you like my owl? I mean, that's not a human. That's not
you
human.
Do.
That's not human banter.
I guess I would at least say this, and we should throw out there that Ridley Scott has been pretty clear now recently in saying, he's a replicant.
He is.
I mean, if you're not agreeing with that, you're kind of an idiot. But I would argue that, I think he's a replicant, meaning Scott thinks that's the most satisfying interpretation, and he's now basically made it impossible with this final cut for us to think otherwise. But I do think it was added after the fact, post-mythology rather than pre-mythology. I think it's as if Ridley Scott had decided, I like the mythology of it better, I'm going to embrace it. But it wasn't necessarily there. I did hear Harrison Ford say in something, though, that It was something Scott was talking to him about on the set, and he constantly rejected it and would act against that. So that,
for me,
that counters
right,
my theory.
Right, right.
So for me, the best film would be, and this speaks to your question, Michael, does it make it a better film if he is or if he isn't? Yeah. The best film for me is the one where it is that tantalizing possibility, where we're not being directed or hit over the head with so many clues, maybe given hints, maybe given suggestions,
yeah,
and you leave the film wondering. I mean, it's a little dispiriting that this movie has gotten so gobbled up by such a controversy.
Yeah.
When it leaves no room for wonder.
No,
and,
not anymore.
You know, that's what the best science fiction
I think
does.
I will also say this. The best science fiction, a lot of it anyway, it really doesn't give a damn about if the narrative's working in conventional, satisfying terms. You know, a movie like Terry Gilliam's Brazil is unthinkable without Blade Runner. And it's got a very different sort of retro-futuristic world building going on. But it's similarly amazing to watch and mm-hmm. to look at. And that's another one that kind of tells a simple, maybe reductive story just enough to kind of hang Gilliam's preoccupations on. And that's written by good people. I mean, Tom Stoppard worked on that script. And I mean, it's got a lot of – but it's not a story film. It just isn't. And I think a lot of Metropolis, Fritz Lang's Metropolis back, which –
which, if anything, sets the tone for Blade Runner.
Absolutely, which influenced everything we're talking about, honestly. Mm-hmm. It's – you know, that's a bunch of – kind of adolescent hooey. I mean, frankly, on story level, I don't care.
Right.
You know, and as much as I admire Blade Runner and have happily kind of re-entered its world and kind of puzzled through these questions about, you know, replicant or no or whatever, you know, just as much, I'm still the 21-year-old I was, struggling to kind of wonder, well, what would have made it really haunt my dreams as opposed to just kind of encourage me to seek out its visual rewards, you know, which is a little different. It's the craft is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think baddie's your answer. I mean, that's a very haunting experience that we're thrust in the middle of, and it's a non-human one, and yet somehow the movie in that climax makes it completely identifiable to me. I mean, that is what elevated this for me on the rewatch. I knew it would be visually stunning. I was glad to see that the mm-hmm. visuals held up so well, but to recognize that it also had this undercurrent of fatalism that did hit, that did land, was probably one of the more rewarding aspects.
Can we at least agree in closing that we wouldn't mind a different composer?
Absolutely.
The Vangelis score really dates it.
I think in the sex scene,
that's really
brutal.
Only point where it bothered me, to be honest.
Yeah, I was going to say, I found it to be almost like this, alongside the rain, this synthetic storm that washed over the movie, especially when we were seeing any cityscape or having any sort of this immersive scene setting in the world. I thought the score worked really well to have this sort of electronic synth heavy score. But then you take those same musical techniques and put them in a love scene that's already not working, and it's disastrous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Blade Runner is available on whatever futuristic platform you watch your movies on, but only replicants know if they're watching the correct cut of the film or not. The final cut of Blade Runner will be released on Ultra HD Blu-ray here coming up September 5th. I don't know if you have a birthday. Maybe this is the perfect gift for you. And it has been playing theatrically this year. It played at the Music Box back in March mm-hmm. for its 35th anniversary. And I saw a comment from a Film Spotting listener on Twitter that they bought tickets to it coming up in their town. So maybe do some Google searches. It is apparently still playing out there and certainly would be worth seeing on the big screen. If you've seen Blade Runner and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
When we come back, the Film Spotting poll will force us to retire replicant style a beloved 1982 movie figure.
Run, E.T., run!
Stay with us if you can stomach it.
Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Film Spotting is presented by Film Spotting listeners, including at Song Warmonger. Been enjoying Film Spotting for a good few years now. Love your insightful, intelligent film analysis, guys. As they say, time to pay the dealer. Also, JD, our good friend from the In Session Film Podcast.
Just wanted to say thanks for all the great content you guys continue to provide each and every week. Lately, I've been listening to not just new shows, but I've also been listening to many of your 2007 episodes as we prepare for our 2007 retrospective on In Session Film. It's been really fun catching up with, well, at least Adam's thoughts on many of these films that I'm sure we'll get to in our retrospective.
So, best films of 2007, looking back at that great cinema year, might just be an idea we have to steal for Film Spotting. Josh, thank you to all who supported the show this week and all of our monthly donors who keep us doing what we're doing.
How old are you?
35. 40.
How much you weigh?
165.
Let's say 220 to be safe. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
We'll get to our top five films of the year 1982 here in a moment with the help of the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips. But first, a little golden brick spotting. Josh, we have been bemoaning the dearth of movies. Really, it's not so much that there probably aren't really good movies out there that are worthy of being in contention for our award that goes annually to an overlooked movie, non-mainstream movie made by a new filmmaker that shows some real promise and artistic vision. There's probably lots of options out there. We just haven't seen them, and we're trying to fill in some of those gaps, and we have two we're going to nominate now. You just heard actor and comedian Brett Gelman in the trailer for Lemon. That's from first-time feature director Janixa Bravo. The movie premiered back in January at Sundance, and it's currently available on most platforms for rent on demand. Josh, you saw it back in Sundance, and I get the sense that you are still wrestling with your reaction to the film.
That's fair, but I definitely think it deserves consideration for Golden Brick. And just a little more background, Gelman's basically this pretty despicable schlub who's dumped by his live-in girlfriend, played by Judy Greer, at the beginning of this, and his career is going nowhere. And so he kind of goes into this downward spiral. I'm going to go against my philosophy here, Adam, of not letting a filmmaker tell me what to think of their movie. Because, as I said, perplexed when I saw this at Sundance, kind of forgot about it, went to it hoping it would be a Golden Brick contender because it seemed to have those qualities, and it just didn't really work for me. Well, Bravo was on the Represent podcast with Aisha Harris, and Aisha said the same thing. She's like, listen, I don't like filmmakers to explain their movies to me, but I don't know what to do with Lemon. So can you at least tell me a little bit about what you were thinking about when you wrote this? And I believe she co-wrote it with Gelman. And I'm not going to go into exactly what she said, but I will ask viewers who go to see this to just keep in mind these films in the background, the Judd Apatow schlub films and those ilk, some of the more independent, maybe even mumblecore films that deal with similar male characters like this. Just kind of keep them in the background because Bravo talked about that, put it in the context of that genre, and it sort of unlocked the movie for me. And I think it might be a little bit brilliant. Now, you could argue... Then normally I do argue, well, then the movie needs to do that work on its own, right? You don't need the filmmaker to tell you here's what it's really doing. But then again, maybe I was just being dense when I saw it in the rush of Sundance film. So want to throw it out there. Definitely one that people are going to have diverse reactions to.
Well, with that line of thinking, maybe you don't need three film critics to explain what it's doing either.
This is why it's a dangerous road to go down.
Well, I'm nominating Brigsby Bear, and Michael has seen this and I think disagrees with my take a little bit on this film. The director is Dave McCary. Kyle Mooney, who I know from Saturday Night Live, is the co-writer and the star of this movie. And I want to read to you the plot description of this film because while I don't want to give away too much about the movie, I want people to go into it as I did, really just waiting for surprises. This is not at all what it ended up being is not at all what I expected based on this type of synopsis. The show Brigsby Bear Adventures is a children's television program produced for an audience of one, James Pope. When the series abruptly ends, Pope's life changes forever as he sets out to finish the storyline himself. When the series abruptly ends, there's a lot of darkness and weirdness in that sentence, or not in that sentence, that the movie deals with, that I can best describe. I'll give you some movies to think about when you watch Brigsby Bear. It's Be Kind Rewind by way of Dogtooth and Room.
That sounds pretty perfect.
It might be, I think, for some people. I'm not going to say it's perfect, but I am going to say I appreciated its ambition, I suppose, with the tone and the way it tried to handle all those disparate tones. It's a very sweet movie, ultimately, at its core, despite all that darkness. And I think it might be too sweet at times.
Sweet, gooey,
yeah,
corn syrupy,
a little bit
high fructosey.
And yet, it surprised me in that way. And despite really the absurdity of the entire storyline, I still found it, I suppose, kind of charming that I felt like the entire cast, made up of some really good comedic actors, you've got Mooney, you've got Michaela Watkins, formerly of SNL as well, they're playing it straight. They are taking on this subject matter without that little twinkle in their eye. And I guess that was enough for me to win me over. I was surprised by
not
it.
Not a golden brick, more of a bronze cinder block.
Okay.
Not a golden brick.
I'm just glad you didn't list Death to Smoochie among those
Haven't seen it.
Yeah, not good.
Okay. Well, maybe it's because my lone big film school project, I made a movie about a guy dressed up in a dog suit and he refused to take it off. So see, it's just speaking to something inside me as an artist. And that's really what's going on here with Brigsby Bear. I'd love to know what listeners think of this movie, or of Lemon. If you've seen it, maybe you can make even more sense of it than Josh apparently has now. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. Next week on the show, it will be a still processing and maybe a still terrified review of It, the adaptation of the scary clown Stephen King book. It opens next weekend. And Josh, you had a very good idea, though we'll have to make sure all the lights are fully on here in the studio.
Yes.
And that I don't watch any of these clips ahead of time, because I might have to cower under the studio board. We are going to do our top five Stephen King movie scares.
And if you come out of the It screening trembling, I will hold your hand through the entire recording of that night's
good,
show.
Good. I may need it.
That may scare you
Michael,
even more.
Michael, will you be at the screening as well? Can you hold my hand?
I will hold, honestly, anything you got. I think whatever you need. When is the screening, by the way?
Next week?
I don't know. Next week sometime.
Next week sometime.
Tuesday night. I think it's
that
on a Tuesday
right.
night.
It.
It.
No, I'll be there. No, I'd love. Seriously, King is born for the cinema, but it's been a while since we've had a really good adaptation of his.
What would you consider a really good King adaptation?
I think Carrie's wonderful. I think Cronenberg's The Dead Zone.
I love
which,
that movie.
Which, I mean, you know, a lot of people, anybody under the age of 40, a lot of them don't even know it. You know, I think it's with the death of Toby Hooper this week, mm-hmm. I think it's a great time to reinvestigate Salem's Lot, the series version.
Okay, well, we were going to get to Hooper, and we will have more in a minute, but he did direct Salem's Lot, and listeners on Twitter, ever since I threw that out, Josh, over the weekend, this top five, they've been suggesting that I relive my childhood traumas by watching Salem's Lot again. That's not going to happen. I don't need to. It's so emblazoned
on your list
my
already.
Brain.
Floating children at the window. Yes.
I'm not watching Salem's Lot again, but it will probably
make the list.
Actually,
that was a beautiful Johnny Mathis ballad from 1958. Floating children at the window.
Floating vampires with yellow eyes at the window. I did throw out a little Twitter poll because I started my homework and I was seeing, okay, what King adaptations have I not seen? How have people ranked them? Is there any homework I need to do? And I threw it out there to Twitter, but I kind of felt like I didn't really need to based on these films. The only decently respected King adaptations that I haven't seen are, even though I saw tons of scenes of it as a kid on TV back in 1984, Children of the Corn.
Oh,
didn't see it. Didn't see 1408.
I've heard that's pretty good.
Of a psychological thriller, but supposedly scary.
It's good.
Right?
It's effective. It's effective.
And then
this
one shouldn't have been part of my poll question, as some tweeters pointed out to me, because it's really not scary, but Dolores Claiborne, starring Misery's Kathy Bates. Those were the three big ones that I felt like maybe I should see. I put it out on Twitter. I said, which one of these should I see for sure? I also gave the option, skip these, you're good. And that's what won it. 39% of Twitter followers of Film Spotting who voted said, I can just skip those three films. And that's probably what I'm going to do. I don't think I need to catch up with the Children of the Corn kind of for this
stoner,
list.
It's kind of a stoner's attitude. Skip it. You're good. I could change the channel if I went.
You have me pegged, Michael. Yeah. You have me so pegged.
Well, the question, too, is like, which ones are going to offer up a scary scene that
right.
could make, you know, it could be a bad movie. I mean, I remember being scared by Maximum Overdrive, which is generally ranked as maybe the worst King
right.
adaptation. But it depends when you saw it and if there might be a moment in it. I don't know. For me, it sounds like maybe I need to watch The Dead Zone.
Oh,
is
yeah.
that going to have
good
some
movie.
Scary scene
well,
options?
So
or is
it's
that
really
more,
good.
It's
I mean,
funny that you say that because I've been wrestling with The Dead Zone and the fact that I love the movie, so I want to include it on the list. I initially had put it into the category of Stephen King movies that I don't consider to be scary.
Right.
But the more I do think about at least one scene in particular and how much it unnerves me, might make my list.
Okay.
Good movie. Worth seeing.
Well, it's Cronenberg, so definitely need
and
to
Christopher
fill that
Walken.
Blind spot, and maybe this will be a good way to do it.
If you have a favorite Stephen King movie scene or scare, leave us a voicemail, and we may use it on next week's show, 312-264-0744. You can also send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, with an MP3 file. We are in the midst of our new Argentine cinema marathon here on Film Spotting. If you're a subscriber to the show already in your podcast feed, you have heard our conversation about the third film in our marathon, Lucrecia Martel's La Cienega from 2001. The plot description, simply the life of two women and their families in a small provincial town in Argentina. Talk about a whole lot of darkness and things unsaid around that sentence.
Mm-hmm.
That's La Cienega. You can find out which platforms that film is available on from our website, filmspotting.net. Our partner for this marathon is Mubi, cult classic independent films from around the world every day. Mubi's experts introduce you to a film they love, and you have a whole month to watch it. So there are always 30 extraordinary films for you to enjoy.
A little hint I'm going to give for what listeners will be in for if they haven't heard that review already. I'm going to say there's some Sofia Coppola in there and some Luis Buñuel.
Yes, Buñuel for sure.
So
yep.
If you ever thought what those two things might look like together, and obviously other things we'll get into in the review, but that's what awaits in La Cienega. Listeners of Film Spotting, you can try Mubi free for a month. Just go to Mubi.com. That's MUBI.com/filmspotting to redeem now.
A couple of highlights from Mubi's offerings right now. Brooks, Meadows, and Lovely Faces from 2016. It's one of their special discoveries by an Egyptian auteur, Yusri Nasrallah, which deftly weaves between drama, comedy, and subtle political insight in a warm and colorful social tapestry. And they, of course, playing along with our new Argentine cinema marathon. Their series is ongoing. Alejo Moyshansky's The Parrot and the Swan from 2013, After 12 from 2014, and Ostende, director Laura Citarella's debut film, also available now over at Mubi. Up next for us, we will get to another film from Lucrecia Martel, her 2008 movie, The Headless Woman. For the full lineup and viewing options, just go to filmspotting.net and click on Marathons. A quick marathon-related note, I thought it might be fun to fit in here. We've heard from a few listeners recently who've been working their way through the Film Spotting archive, some we've shared in our donation segment, and there's some others who we had no idea were going through the entire catalog of shows, but multiple people sending us the same note because they're coming across this show, and apparently it's like a time machine. Josh, way back in 2007, I made a promise about something that would happen here in 2017 on the show.
Prophecy.
Yeah, prophecy. It hasn't happened yet, and it's probably not going to happen. Zane DeVault is one of the listeners who writes, I've been listening to your show on and off for a long while, but earlier this year, I decided to scratch my OCD itch and go back to the beginning to listen to every episode. Back somewhere around episode 70, Adam and Sam were discussing why they wouldn't be reviewing the new Harry Potter movie and mentioned that we'd have to wait until 2017 for the Harry Potter marathon. I just checked the marathon page and couldn't find a reference to it, so it must be scheduled for after New Argentine Cinema.
There's no way you were serious about that when you said it.
Well, we'll get to that in a moment, Josh. We got another bit of feedback here.
This one comes from Algard, Norway. Alexander Waldemar, who I met, not in Norway, but at the London meetup.
Really?
Yeah, Alexander was
Did
there.
Did he come all the way from Norway?
No, he was in England at the time.
Okay,
so,
I'm not impressed.
Yeah, Sorry, Alexander. Anyways, he says, just listen to Cinecast episode 83, where Adam promised a Harry Potter marathon in 2017. So when is this happening? You already did a Fast and the Furious marathon, and I feel like you owe it to the people who have been waiting since 2006 for this. I can't wait to hear your thoughts on the cinematic qualities of prepubescent boys and girls running around shouting pseudo-Latin at each other.
Okay, so I did go into the archive because I was dying to fill in some blanks here. I don't remember making this promise at all or why it even would have come up. And I think it was actually in sort of a year look ahead, maybe. And it was the film Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix coming out in 2007 that we were saying, no, sorry, we're not going to review it. And then it turns out in July 2007, episode 168 of the show, this is the show description. When Adam and Sam announced earlier this spring that they were going to skip Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, as they had every Potter film since the series debut back in 01, FilmSpotting listeners started a campaign of sorts to convince the host that the series, starting with the Alfonso Cuarón-directed third film, Prisoner of Azkaban, was worth catching up with. Adam dutifully brought himself up to speed. Sam remained in the dark. Both treaded skeptically into Phoenix, but at least one of them was greatly rewarded for his effort. So I've already actually done the marathon of sorts. I think the only one of the Harry Potter films I still have not seen. I don't think I ever bothered to see that second one, the other Chris Columbus effort. And I'm good with that.
I thought you were going to say the second one of the final two.
No, we talked about it on the show.
I'm just going to leave it go.
We reviewed that on the show. Some of these have been discussed, including Phoenix. So I did my homework. Sam didn't. Order of the Phoenix ended up being my favorite film of the entire Harry Potter series.
Really? Well,
yes.
I'm going to go with a conventional choice, Azkaban. I don't know that I'm on board for a marathon. I'm not quite as snobby
no
as
point.
You and Sam were.
There's no
like,
point. I'm not watching
the
Chris
whole
Columbus.
Franchise from the beginning.
I know. We were idiots.
But I do wonder how much you'd rediscover in doing that. You know, these are films that I've mostly appreciated for the production design and the actors doing the great British thespians doing things on the side. I think they're all pretty much good films, but a marathon?
Yeah, no, that's not going to happen. I'm going to put it out there right now.
You can just do a very quiet marathon of the pauses Alan Rickman would deploy between the second to last word in a sentence. And the last word.
Now that sounds like fun.
You saying he was formulaic in those?
No. I seriously, I loved it, but nobody had more fun with pauses. You could rent one of the pauses, move in for a month.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, if you are listening to the archives, and really, I don't know why you would unless you were being tortured, and you find any other decade-old unfulfilled promises, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. All 12-plus years of the show are available in the archives at our website, filmspotting.net. It's true, we used to be called Cinecast, and we had to change the name because Michael refused to come on the show until we got a better name. So,
such a diva.
Now you know the history.
Yeah.
E.T. Home phone.
E.T. phone home. E.T. phone home. E.T. phone home. He wants to call somebody.
E.T., you can phone a friend, but I'm not sure it's going to help. A few weeks back, we were looking ahead to this week's show. We posed a little 1982 death match to you. E.T. versus Blade Runner. Drew Barrymore there with Henry Thomas in that Steven Spielberg classic E.T. Not just the highest grossing movie of 82, but of the entire 1980s. It's one of the most beloved films of all time. So in this death match, where only one of these films will continue to exist for future generations to enjoy, naturally, it was going to be E.T. in a walk. Right, Josh?
Mm-hmm.
E.T. only received 36% of the vote. I mean, not only did E.T. lose, but this is ridiculous. 64% going to Blade Runner?
Yeah.
No.
The forces of darkness crush the forces
of light. What is this all about?
They did. This whole poll question, by the way, for us, and I think a good chunk of our audience, really intense, really tough. Michael's over here like, meh. They're both okay.
Get rid of them both.
I feel more strongly about that. But no, put Close Encounters in there. Now we got
right.
You know, that's, see, anyway, let's not discuss it.
For listeners as distraught as I am, I know rules are that the losing film gets destroyed. I'm hanging on to one copy. I'm going to take it with me into the bunker.
Okay.
And it will be preserved.
Okay. Good to know. Faith Johnson says, this is perhaps one of the hardest decisions I've ever had to make. Both films are very dear to me. Ultimately, I went with Blade Runner. While I do think E.T. is a transcendent film, I know much of my love for it is all wrapped up in childhood nostalgia.
Revisit it, Faith. Francisco Silva from Lisbon, Portugal says it has to be Blade Runner, not only due to the obvious visual and mood influence on much of the science fiction cinema that followed it, including Spielberg's AI, but also being one of those rare films that becomes an argument starter. Any two people seeing Blade Runner will have different opinions about it, from what version to watch, how to interpret the ending, which ending is true, who is and isn't a replicant, and what kind of replicant they are. Sounds familiar. The discussion around it transcends plot and goes to the art of filmmaking and the author's authority over his work. E.T. is also nice. His finger lights up. Yay.
Oh, that's some good shade.
Dismissive.
Who killed the child in you, Francis?
Dismissive. I love it.
Peter Nesson says, I am shocked Blade Runner is winning so easily. Hell, we don't even know which version they are voting for. Except for mood, the movie suffers somewhat from Ridley Scott's philosophical meanderings. E.T., however, well, that's pure entertainment. Who cares if it's, in essence, a kid's movie? It's a Pantheon-worthy kid's movie. It is iconic, and if I need to live without a movie for the rest of my life, I'll lose the downer and keep the heartlight.
Okay. Jeff Gibson in Olympia, Washington closes us out. Having rewatched Blade Runner recently, I've seen all 4 of 5 versions. I can say, as worthy of respect as it is, it's overrated. I vote E.T. all the way. The score, the final scene, the quotable dialogue. This poll is like deciding between your heart or your mind. Blade Runner is certainly intelligent and visually influential, but I'm never as emotionally engaged with Deckard and the replicants. That's my next band's name, by the way, as I am with Elliot and E.T., I vote with my heart.
Good choice, Jeff.
Okay. There it is. E.T. gone forever unless you are going to join Josh in the bunker. What else will be in the bunker? I mean, not movie-wise, but
I've never been as disturbed by a poll result as this. So there will be others where I'll break the rules.
Well, I wonder if you'll be disturbed by this next poll and the results, because I have a feeling that your number one choice is probably not going to be where it's going to come out. Michael, we are looking ahead to the new film from Darren Aronofsky. Do you want to give the title a shot? Because Josh and I had differing takes on it last week.
Mother?
What? No, another question.
That's a question.
Mother?
Let me try it again. Mother?
There you go. See?
See, that seemed like more of a question.
They don't teach punctuation anymore.
I have a bootleg and it's just called Ma. So
it's got Jennifer Lawrence, Javier Bardem, Ed Harris, Michelle Pfeiffer. It looks fairly creepy. I think that's fair to say. And we'll find out here in a second. Aronofsky, one of those directors through 6 features, I think, arguably hasn't made a bad film. But then again, I haven't seen Noah, so I'm not sure that I can fully answer that question. Our question to you, very simply, what is Darren Aronofsky's best film? And we are going in chronological order here with your options.
So that means you can choose from Pi, Requiem for a Dream, The Fountain, The Wrestler, Black Swan, or Noah.
Okay. His best film. Michael, where do you come out?
Black Swan.
Okay.
His biggest film, and I think it's the one I like the best.
Good choice.
Yeah.
Josh, The Fountain?
Black Swan. It's between The Fountain and Requiem for a Dream for me. Black Swan, I need to revisit. Did not entirely get on its vibe the first time. And I know I'm probably alone on that.
No, not alone. Definitely. It was a divisive film, but I was in on Black Swan. If I was going to rank them, I thought about this today. I'll go real quick. Requiem is still at number one. I think that I might actually have Pi second. But I have not seen it since it came out or when it came out on home video. Black Swan would be next, The Wrestler after that, The Fountain. And I like The Fountain, but it would be last of those 5. And Noah, haven't seen.
Noah? Well, you should say. I suppose I'll see that again sometime.
But really?
Yeah, Noah, I mean, it's not dismissible. And a lot of it's kind of weirdly compelling.
Did we review that one together?
Yeah,
on
but
the show,
it's,
Michael?
It's,
I think
it's
we did,
a little
yeah.
nerds. You know, it's a little
it
nerds.
It has issues, and yeah, it's worth seeing because it's unique as a Bible epic, absolutely, right. Which you'd expect from Aronofsky.
Yeah, it's a squirrely Bible epic.
Yeah, of course, I'm going with Requiem as my number one answer because I just want to stick with that. I'm certainly not going to revisit Requiem for a Dream, and actually, that's probably not true. I'll break down at some point, but that for me has always been on my one-timers list. It is such a rough go that I don't know if I have the stamina to go through that trauma again, but I remember really appreciating that film when I saw it back in theaters. We want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. If you leave some feedback, and we hope you do, please let us know where you're listening from. Speaking of feedback, one last little bit here. We got an email from Alex with a couple images in it that did catch my eye. Alex writes, first time writing into the podcast, but longtime listener. I was wondering if I could get your 2 cents about the possibility of Darren Aronofsky's Mother being a secret remake of Rosemary's Baby, tied in with the fact that the director has come out saying he wants the audience to know nothing about the film before seeing it. I'm always concerned when a film relies on not knowing a twist or surprise before going in. Love the show. Now, he's not just basing it on that little bit of information that Aronofsky's being mysterious and the trailer really gives nothing away. He sent over the movie posters. And the Mother movie poster is a straight ripoff of Rosemary's Baby. Ooh, like, beyond just
one of the great movie
the normal ripoffs. It's absolutely taken right from Rosemary's Baby. Yeah. And so is it possible that we've got the Ruth Gordon role being played by Michelle Pfeiffer?
I don't know. I hope not. I mean, I hope he's got something more interesting up his sleeve than that. Seriously, I do. We all know Rosemary's Baby pretty well, which is, talk about a film that holds up very nicely.
Oh, love
it. I mean, it's almost an unduplicatable tone, and Polanski turned out to be the right person, you know, to bring that material to life. But yeah, if you look at the posters,
we will post this over at filmspotting.net.
That's it.
Yeah.
So you look
looks
at awfully Mother,
familiar.
You look at Rosemary's Baby.
Yep.
I mean.
I like the sitcom version better. Ma!
There's one more thing. A terrible presence is in there with her. So much rage. So much betrayal. I've never sensed anything like it. I don't know what hovers over this house. But it was strong enough to punch a hole into this world, take your daughter away from you.
The unmistakable voice of Zelda Rubinstein as the eccentric medium Tangina in 1982's Poltergeist. Poltergeist director, so to speak, Toby Hooper, passed away over the weekend. He was 74. It is a long-held belief that actually Steven Spielberg, who was a producer on that film, actually directed much of the film, but something contractually or whatever was keeping him from technically being the director. Toby Hooper stepped in and was on set, but most have contested that it's actually a Spielberg effort. Nevertheless, whether Toby Hooper directed Poltergeist or not, no one disputes that he is the director of one of the most influential horror films of all time, 1974's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oof.
A good film.
Yeah, scared me. I mean, I didn't see it for years.
It scared me when I saw it for the first time in 2005.
Yeah. And a lot of it, I think, a lot of it back in 74 when I was not seeing it, but a lot of my raver horror movie friends were seeing it at age 13, 14, sneaking into the drive-in. But that title alone was so vicious. You know, when you think, there weren't that many titles like that out there, even on the grindhouse, you know, exploitation drive-in circuit. But when you see the movie now, and you're kind of amazed how little really nasty gore there is in it, but there's a ton of dread, and what violence there is in it is really rough. But it is absolutely three steps above so much else. And I vastly prefer Texas Chainsaw, and also beyond before that, the movie that really influenced it the most, George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, so much more than a big budget, big studio bid for the same audience, The Exorcist. You know, a film I constantly...
Please don't get Josh going.
I argue with people all the time.
This is why it's always such a pleasure to have you on the show, Michael.
No, whatever.
Just making a note here.
You know, and they're all, you know, very low in many ways. All three of those movies are very low-intentioned. You know, they're just trying to get the screw in your gut as hard as you can. But the last 30 seconds of Chainsaw, I think, sent me out on the most destabilizing note of, like,
it's a good word.
Happy, sad. There's a survivor, but she's clearly lost her mind because of the trauma she's just been through. And there's Leatherface, who's lost this round, but he's doing his little dance of death against the Texas sunrise.
Yeah.
And it's a new day, and, you know, he's just one of God's creatures enjoying a new day. And, you know, it's a really rough mixed. No, and I'll never forget it.
Well, and you could flip that story, too, regarding Poltergeist and say, obviously, there are Spielbergian touches all over that film, but there's also Texas Chainsaw Massacre touches. I mean, there is an insidiousness to Poltergeist. We'll talk about Poltergeist a little bit more in a bit, but I think you can see plenty of Hooper there as well.
Well, we are going to talk about Poltergeist, it seems, as we get to our top five films of 1982, of course, the year that Blade Runner was released. And we're going to do this a little bit differently than we normally structure our top fives. We're not just going to go around the circle here, counting down 5 to 1. We have 5 slots to fill. We have 11 movies that make up those 5 slots. So there is some overlap, but there are some outliers. In fact, there are 7 outliers, and we're going to get to those first after we take care of just a little bit of business, Josh. I had Blade Runner at number 3. You had Blade Runner at number 3. So we're just going to throw that out there right now. Blade Runner in the top 5. Michael's going to be the black sheep here, who is not going to be part of that little replicant party. Doesn't love it enough.
So
but...
my honorable mention list, man.
Okay.
I mean, you know, more of a participation
I'll take
trophy,
that.
You know.
I'll take that. Blade Runner, though, on ours.
Did we cover everything? I mean, I
had more notes. Yeah, I had a lot more notes,
maybe
actually.
The only thing I'd throw out there, and we mentioned Daryl Hannah, how good she is, but didn't really get into it. Maybe from I've seen of her best performance, it's very gleeful, this sort of malevolent replicant that she plays, who's enjoying her superpowers, I guess, that she has, and this sort of lethal acrobat. Almost imagine that she'd fit in as one of Joker's goons, you know,
sure.
Especially the Jack Nicholson vision of the Joker could see her right mm-hmm. alongside there. So I think she's fantastic in Blade Runner.
Yeah, she really is. So now we get to those outliers. And Michael, you're all alone on this 1982 island. Start us off. Give us your number 5.
My number 5 is Moonlighting, which is a film, I don't know if you guys have seen this. But
no,
this
always
is,
wanted to, because I love Jeremy Irons.
This is Jerzy Skolimowski's very sly black comedy. It's set in 1981, and the premise is this. A Polish government official has bought a flat in London, right, just before the Polish government's ban on the Solidarity movement back home. And the owners of the flat remodeling the place or gutting it. They have a Polish construction crew headed by an English-speaking Pole played by Jeremy Irons. And when the coup takes place back home, it's in the best interest of getting this job done, Irons' character figures, to keep this news about the coup a secret from his co-workers. And from there, this comedy follows the foreman as he just kind of devolves into this desperate situation. He's shoplifting, he's scheming, he's finagling, he's falling in love, you know, more or less. And I had never, at the time when I was 21, I remember going, being home from college, going down to Chicago with my folks, going out to dinner. And hey, I saw a movie on Siskel and Ebert recommended. Never really heard about anything like it. But my mom said, ooh, Jeremy Irons, he's dreamy.
Uh-huh.
I think, let's go. Let's go see the movie Michael wants to see. So I drug him into the Fine Arts Theater. And, you know, my mom and dad were kind of like Nipper the dog, you know, looking with that cocked head at his master's voice like, huh? You know, what did we just see? And I wasn't really that much clearer on kind of what I'd just seen. But I'd never seen a movie that was that kind of deft in this mixture of comedy and drama. And, you know, and I'll tell you, that movie's got a lot to say about you know, all the stuff we now associate with just sort of the EU and all these countries mm-hmm. in crisis and fluid borders and exploited cheap labor going to other countries to kind of just to survive. You know, this movie really speaks to the future, which is, of course, the present.
Before we left, customs checked all our luggage. That bag contained hammers, drills, and an axe. Today is the 5th of December, 1981. Warsaw Black Market exchanges £1 for well over 1,000 zlotys, the average weekly wage. I landed in London with £1,200 in my pocket, a sum that would have taken me 25 years to earn.
Yeah, as I said, it's been a regret of mine for a long time because of that appreciation for Irons and hearing so many good things about the director as well. I'm going to get to one of my outliers. This is my number 4 pick. And as we said, we're dancing around a little bit. You don't have to follow along here. If you want to reference our lists in numerical order later, you can do that. Just go to filmspotting.net and click on list. But my number 4 is a movie you mentioned in your setup to Blade Runner, Michael. It is John Carpenter's The Thing, a remake of the Howard Hawks film from the 50s, I believe. It was my number 1 monster movie from June 2011 here on the show. And from April 2014, my number 2 Thing from Space that came to destroy us. And according to an IndieWire article I came across today, the first director considered to make this remake of The Thing, Toby Hooper, apparently. But yeah. John Carpenter, of course, ended up making it. And another fun fact...
It was too gory for Toby Hooper.
Maybe. Another fun fact in that article, Carpenter had come off making Elvis on TV with Kurt Russell, I think, in 79, and then in 81 had done Escape from New York. And so he said, I don't want to get stuck in a rut here with Kurt Russell. I don't think I'm going to cast him as MacReady. And someone talked him out of it. Maybe he just came to his senses and he cast Kurt Russell. And thankfully he did, because it's one of my favorite Kurt Russell performances. I've said it before about this movie, but you talk about my favorite word, stakes. This is all of humanity, potentially, despite the fact that it takes place in this frozen tundra out away from the rest of the civilized world. You know that if this creature, which is constantly assimilating, and you know there really is no stopping it, it will just be too late for humanity at some point. And I think what I really love about the film is even scarier than the monster itself is the sense of distrust and paranoia that pervades this group. The humans themselves are scarier than that monster. And the ending to me feels more relevant than ever and more suspenseful, maybe. Just that end scene, without spoiling it, two guys sitting there waiting each other out is more terrifying in some ways than anything else in the movie. Brigsby Bear, mentioned earlier in the show as a Golden Brick candidate, a teen in that movie who is a filmmaking aficionado, has a Thing poster.
That film was seriously nervy, and I think a lot of people should take a look at it if they don't remember exactly how the effects and the gore, which is considerable, works in that film, because this is pre-digital, of course, mm-hmm. and it's all very practical effects, like Stan Winston and his collaborator Rob Bottin, I think.
Yeah,
this is old school. Effects, but it's also kind of, thanks to Romero and a lot of other filmmakers, kind of a new level of gore. But I would say it's truly intelligently deployed mm-hmm. extreme gore. And it's one of the movies you can point to and say, you know, not all extreme gore is created equal and creates an equal effect.
Well said, Michael. And
thank you.
Please continue, as we are now ready for another outlier, your number four film of 82.
My number four is The Verdict, directed by Sidney Lumet, from a script by David Mamet. And it stars Paul Newman as the alcoholic attorney who's got one shot at redemption with this sort of long shot court case. And it's really a courtroom drama in many ways. And it's, you know, for Mamet, it's an unusually tightly plotted picture based on a novel. It's a film I wasn't really sure which way I was thinking. You know, I enjoyed it at the time, although even as a pup, I thought this is one nasty movie toward women. I mean, there's like one of the big kind of arguably audience baiting moments is kind of the most galling and unconscionable. It's when the Newman character just hauls off and clocks the woman who he's been sleeping with. Charlotte Rampling, who turns out to be kind of a double dealer for the other side of this legal fight, right? It's a very queasy making mm-hmm. moment at best, but that film in almost every other respect has aged extremely well, and I think Newman's performance and just the way that courtroom summation is handled by Lumet, I think a lot of what I liked about Lumet as a filmmaker in the early days, 12 Angry Men and all kinds of things, you know, he's really kind of retained How do you handle a performance and how do you kind of serve a story with a very unobtrusive camera but with a real eye toward performance detail? It's one of Newman's best performances.
Yes.
I'm an attorney on trial before the bar representing my client. My client. You open your mouth, you're losing my case for me.
Now listen to me, Phil.
No, you listen to me. All I want on this trial was a fair shake. Okay. Push me into court 5 days early. I lose my star witness, and I can't get a continuance, and I don't care. I'm going up there, I'm going to try it, I'm going to let the jury decide. You know, they told me about you. Said you're a hard ass, you're a defendant's judge. No, I don't care. I said to hell with it, to hell with it!
Look, Galvin, many years ago...
Come on. Hey, don't give me that shit about you being a lawyer, too. I know about you. You couldn't hack it as a lawyer. You were a bag man for the boys downtown, and you still are. I know about you.
Are you done?
You're damn right I'm done.
And he got zoomed out at the Oscars by Ben Kingsley, the only survivable element of Richard Attenborough's film Gandhi. But, you know, you couldn't stop Gandhi that year. And it's funny because it's not a movie that we seem to be talking about much tonight.
No. I'm guessing it's not going to come up. Of course, my excuse is I never saw it, but I'm not in a hurry to see it.
You never saw Gandhi?
No, I didn't. Given me a reason to.
We often do the top five we would have named in 82.
Yeah.
Even though I was, what, like eight? Probably would have been Gandhi, because that was one of the first grown-up movies I was
prestige
taken
picture.
To. Right?
Oh,
really?
So I thought, like, I'm really seeing something here. And I remember it felt that, you know, that immensity to me then, for sure, but I have not felt the need to revisit it either.
Well, the scenes I've seen more recently, Kingsley's performance is really, really good, and it's the only really, really good element of the entire picture.
Hmm. Josh, finally, you get to make another pick. You're number five.
My number five, we'll return briefly here for a little bit more Poltergeist talk. That's where I have it at number five. And, you know, what were Hooper's contributions? Well, I think you can point to some of the personal nature of the scares here. Spielberg, he's done monsters, right? Like Jaws and the dinosaurs, and those are all larger creatures. And there's something, just like Texas Chainsaw, there's an intimacy to the violence there. Think about that clown, that terrifying clown, yeah, which is personal because it's a toy and also because it's wrapping itself around that poor little kid the clown made. It was my number three terrifying character, Adam, on episode 419. So clearly I saw this film when I was way too young, and it did do a number on me. But revisiting it since, I do think it holds up. Now, looking at it as a Spielberg film, the flip side to E.T., set in another suburb, you can clearly see how this is coming a little bit from the dark underbelly of his id, because we have suburbia turned inside out here. Jo Beth Williams and Craig T. Nelson, another family that we're in the midst of and we intimately get to know in this suburban dream home that has been unwisely built over ancestral burial grounds. There's also this element about the disturbed spirit speaking through the television, and what a brilliant touch that is, not only as a visual, but also as this prescient sense of the way television may come to rip the American family apart. I mean, this is something that people were wrestling with in 82, how TV is going to change family dynamics when it became such an integral part of the nuclear American family. And just think about the evil spirits coming through The Bachelor nowadays, Michael. You know, this was like just letting us know what was on the way. So
I've always loved Poltergeist, and I probably saw it way too young as well. And I agree. I think what I've seen of it recently, never watched it in its entirety, but whenever it comes on, I'm always struck by how much it holds up. It's a very smart satire of that 80s time when you have those two characters in Craig T. Nelson and Jo Beth Williams. They come off as people who they're baby boomers. They probably lived through the 60s and were fighting the good fight for peace and love against the Vietnam War. And you know what? When it came time to start a family, they joined it. They became part of the establishment, and they were willing to do whatever it took. Now, maybe they didn't know what they were doing when they built that house.
But they still smoke pot. That's the one.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
they sneak into the bedroom and they smoke a little pot. They still get a little high. But at the end of the day, all they really care about, it would seem, is that perfect dream home, regardless of what the costs are there. So I love Poltergeist. Almost made my list.
All right. We're going to have a few more outliers from 1982 after the break. I think this is where Adam's Porky's pick is probably going to come in.
Yeah.
Then we're going to get to some consensus choices for the best of that year. The Film Spotting Top 5 continues in a moment. Stay with us.
There are mountains in our way, but we climb a stair every day. The lift is up where we belong.
Tell me what I want to hear. I want your D.O.R.
No, sir.
I want your D.O.R.
I ain't gonna quit.
Spell it. D.O.R.
I ain't gonna quit.
Yeah, then you can be free, and you and your daddy can get drunk and go hall chasing again, huh?
No, sir.
D.O.R.
I ain't gonna quit.
All right, then you can forget it. You're out.
Don't you do it. Don't you. I got nowhere else to go. I got nowhere else to go.
We get back into our top five films of 82 countdown with that clip from An Officer and a Gentleman, a movie I loved in the 1980s and watched constantly. I could have finished that clip for you Zach Mayo's quote, Richard Gere, there in that scene with the proper inflection without re-listening to it, Michael. Wow. That's how many times I saw An Officer and a Gentleman, and he was going up against Louis Gossett Jr., who won an Oscar that year, Best Supporting Actor for that film. Now, we were reading an article. You did a little bit of writing in the Tribune about the films of 1982, looking back on it.
I don't like your dismissive tone.
A little bit of writing.
A little bit of writing. A little something.
It felt a little cavalier to me. What can I say? But I enjoyed it. I especially enjoyed hearing about your first viewing experience of An Officer and a Gentleman. I wonder if you'd share.
I go home to West Caldwell, New Jersey, with my then girlfriend Lori Grossman, and you know we go to the movies with her parents, Herb and Marcia, and her grandparents, Izzy and Fanny. Right?
You're making these names up, right?
I'm not. Grandparent names.
You're protecting the innocent.
Tootsie's sold out, so we got Officer and Gentleman will be fine. Okay, fine. Well, the sex scene comes in, and for the time, it's not particularly racy, but it's a little rough. And I'm sitting next to Grandma Fanny, and she starts monologuing. It's like the post show discussion moved to the middle of the show, to the screening, right? And she was just like, "Oh my, oh no, no, oh no, my God," you know. And she's it was just like this low murmur, and I really clenched up in the everywhere, and I never really relaxed, and eventually the relationship dissolved, you know, over the screen.
I can't imagine. We've all been there, though. I don't know with Grandma Fanny, but we've all been there.
I didn't know there was a way An Officer and a Gentleman could be worse.
Oh,
I think you just described
it, Michael.
Don't hurt
me. That film's so good.
It is disheartening that Adam likes such a dumb
movie.
Oh,
I love it.
Although Deborah Winger's fantastic.
David Keith is fantastic. Richard Gere is fantastic.
No, Richard Gere is not fantastic.
Terrible. He's awful. And Gossett Jr., what's disturbing to me about that movie, Sugar Britches. What's with Sugar Britches?
You heard that a lot in the 80s, Josh.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I think the only time
Josh,
I ever heard it
I think
was
Josh,
an officer
Josh,
and a gentleman.
Josh particularly would have heard a lot of that.
Exactly.
No.
What is going on?
No, I don't know. That movie's junk. It doesn't take
place
on. It is
not.
It's science fiction. It's like, whatever. You can enjoy it, I guess, but only for Deborah Winger for me.
Well, I'm stuck as a 7-year-old watching that film being
seven,
being just blown away by it. Oh yeah,
seven.
Yeah, it was full of mysteries.
R-rated,
Michael,
who's letting you into the R-rated movies?
My parents, they just let me watch HBO. They just let me watch HBO.
Iowa.
I was a latchkey kid.
Iowa.
They weren't paying attention to me at
just
all,
roaming
Michael.
All over Iowa.
So I mean, look how well I turned out. We get back into our top five of 82 countdown with that clip, with that Officer and a Gentleman dismissal. And I wanted to set the list up a little bit more. We'll recap briefly, though, our choices, because we're a few picks in. We've each actually made two choices, even if we've gone about it in a really roundabout way. So let's reveal those again here now. Josh, your two picks.
Yeah, so I named my number five, Poltergeist, and my number three, Blade Runner.
Michael.
My number five, Moonlighting, and my number four, The Verdict.
And my number four was John Carpenter's The Thing, and I'm with Josh on Blade Runner at number three. So a couple more outliers before we get to four movies that made at least two of our lists. We did not have a movie make all three of our lists. A little bit surprised about that. But first, I wanted to reference an article from Alan Sepinwall I found, I think from 2015. Uproxx.com had their writers describe what they thought the best year in cinema was. And Alan Sepinwall actually took up the mantle for 82. Ooh. He said it has the best kids movie ever. You can guess which one he's thinking of there. It has perhaps the best comedy ever. That's going to come up here in a moment. It has the best movie about young men grappling with adulthood. Michael, that movie would be?
Diner.
It has perhaps the best comedy about high school social mores.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
It definitely has the best teen stoner character in Sean Penn's Jeff Spicoli. Alan writes, it gave us the best Star Trek movie by far. Sorry, Josh, in Wrath of Khan.
Just about to talk about that one.
Okay, well, we're leading up to it. The best of the Rocky sequels in Rocky 3. I'm sure that's your number one. I'm sure that's your number one, Michael.
Okay.
A Design of the Future in Blade Runner, the nearly every sci-fi movie since has been trying to copy. We discussed that earlier in the show. The movie and the scene that made Eddie Murphy into a superstar. It's true. In 48 Hours, in Sophie's Choice, Meryl Streep's best dramatic performance, and with The Verdict on your list, Michael, mm-hmm. Paul Newman's best performance, Sepinwall argues. So he does make a pretty good case for 82 as a pretty good film year, and we're going to see if some of those choices do come up here in our final picks. We are at another one of yours, Michael. You're number three.
Number three. I'm with Alan Sepinwall. I think Star Trek II.
Don't do it, Michael.
Yes. Star Trek II, colon. Yes. Star Trek II, colon.
This almost makes up for The Exorcist.
Colon,
and Officer and a Gentleman.
Colon, The Wrath of Khan. I love that film. I love it.
Why?
I think it's still the most entertaining Star Trek picture.
Yep.
And I've liked a lot of them, old and new, but Nicholas Meyer directed it. It feels like a good, fast, medium-weight blockbuster that's not trying to eat you alive or just set up the next movie. It's the movie where William Shatner mysteriously becomes a real actor in the last 10 minutes.
I'm doing something I've never done. I'm shutting Josh's mic off.
What's the running time on Wrath of Khan?
I'm actually shutting Josh's mic off.
So 10 minutes of decent acting gets you in the top five of the year.
Look, Ricardo Montalban makes up for all the rest. He's great in that.
So, yes.
Yeah,
so interesting we talk about Blade Runner.
And it quotes Moby Dick.
You have a villain in Blade Runner who is so much more overacting in some scenes to a purpose, whereas Montalban is just ridiculous.
They're two different movies
also,
to compare them.
This Khan is so much more ponderous than Blade Runner about its existential leanings.
Sure.
It's so full of itself.
Disagree.
Absolutely full of itself.
He's got revenge on his mind, and that's powerful.
Really?
Yeah, that's
powerful,
Josh. I
wouldn't have picked that up.
I'm with you, Michael. Good movie.
For me, it's just pure enjoyment, you know. And I'm not even that much of a Star Trek freak, you know. But I think that film, it doesn't have the panache visually of some of the later ones, the more recent ones, which I've enjoyed. And it doesn't really have the ponderousness, God knows, of the one Robert Wise directed, the first one, which, I mean, that first approach to the Enterprise in the first movie, I feel like that scene has not yet ended.
Maybe
and,
not.
And the second one, like all that wiped away. I just thought, this is it. This is how you make one of these.
Well done, Michael.
Can we move on
Well
now?
Done. We can. Though now we're just going to have Michael make fun of me, so I'm not sure why this is a good idea. But we're actually going to my number one film of 1982. Speaking of being stuck in nostalgia mode, and a movie I saw probably as an 8-year-old on TV and watched incessantly. It's been in the penalty box over the years here on the show because I've talked about it so much. But if we're making the films of 82 list, I can't not put The World According to Garp at number one. Robin Williams in that film, directed by George Roy Hill. It was actually my number two movie of the entire 80s on an old top five here on the show. And the question I posted on Letterboxd when I watched this film most recently back in 2015 was, what do you say about a movie that feels like a part of you? That's how I feel about this movie. I just watched it constantly as a kid. I was drawn to it. And I go into a lot more detail about this on the Cinephiliacs podcast with Peter Labuza. Mm. We talk about this movie for at least 30 minutes. If you want to seek that out, I'll put the link to it in our show notes at filmspotting.net. If you want really just the quick Cliff's Notes version of it, all the subjects I'm most passionate about now are all there on display in Garp, talking about movies and art in general that deals with the role of the artist in the creative process, mortality, certainly, constructing narratives. You've got lots of blurred lines between reality and fantasy. And in terms of something I relate to now as a parent, the movie is very much based on the John Irving book, which I also love very much, about the constant state of dread that a parent lives in. And Robin Williams certainly captures that in the movie. Something about the sexual politics of the movie and the cultural politics of it as an 8-year-old, I obviously didn't understand, but that just made me want to watch the movie more and try to understand it and what was driving these characters. So one of the things I think about and one of the things I asked on that podcast with Peter was, if this movie seems to contain all of my preoccupations now when it comes to movies, were they somehow in me? And The World According to Garp just was a vessel for those, or did it plant them there somehow? Mm-hmm. Was it something about that film that if I had never seen it at that impressionable age, would I still be fascinated by those topics now? I don't know. And I will never know, but it's fun to think about sometimes. Mm. So, Garp, my number one.
I always wanted a child. I could have had one by myself, I would have, but God or nature or whatever. Well, you know, you need a man. You know what men are like, full of lust. I can talk to you because you're past all that.
What?
You're not well enough to walk. It's a very nasty bump. Anyway, the war was on. I was a nurse. One day they brought in a tail gunner who had been wounded by anti-aircraft in a raid over Germany. A splinter of steel had lodged in his brain, and all he could say was his name, Gob. For medical reasons I couldn't quite understand, he also had a constant erection. Well, he deteriorated steadily. Till one day all he could say was part of his name, Arp. It was then that I knew that he wouldn't last much longer. His erections continued, however, quite unabated.
I see.
God, I haven't seen that since I was 21. I mean, right. I liked it pretty well then. Although,
yeah,
I
Glenn Close as his mother, Jenny
Fields,
very good.
Yeah, I like Mary Beth Hurt really good in it. Yeah, John Lithgow, very early
very
success
good.
For him. I'm not sure George Roy Hill was really the director for that material.
Mm-hmm. No,
so
that's fair.
I would disagree with you.
Okay.
Can we delete your earlier comments?
No, but okay. Let's see if we can agree on your next pick, our last outlier. Then we're going to get to the really good stuff here. I'm really hoping it's going to be Rocky III here at number two.
Yes, that's right. It's Diner. Barry Levinson's
okay.
Diner. Is that what I heard you
close.
Say? Yeah, writer-director Barry. A film I really adored at the time. You know, it's about a – if you haven't seen it, I just really recommend you take a look at it to see what kind of a commercial but very low-key and really interestingly idiosyncratic movie. Just another, quote, just a coming-of-age film in some ways. It's about a group of guys a few years out of high school. It's 1959 Baltimore, Levinson's own life story in some ways. But the guys, even though they're young adults, you know, they're still back in high school in a way. But the casting is just sometimes it just gets I suppose mm-hmm. you could argue that Garp has the same magically right casting. But Diner, for me, when you look at Kevin Bacon, Mickey Rourke has never been better.
He's so good.
Tim Daly, you know.
Ellen Barkin.
A medium talent, Tim Daly. Another medium talent, Steve Guttenberg, actually top billed in that film. And he's wonderful.
He is, yeah.
And, you know, Paul Reiser, Daniel Stern, and those scenes with Ellen Barkin and Daniel Stern, those are the ones that really, really sting and hold up still. And it's just kind of like very rocky marriage, mm-hmm. really in its state, but, you know, two people not really ready for it.
Is it too complicated to just keep my records in the category, okay? Just put the rock and roll in with the rock and roll. Put the R&B in with the R&B. I mean, you're not going to put Charlie Parker in with the rock and roll, would you? Would you?
I don't know. Who is Charlie Parker?
Jazz! Jazz! He was the greatest jazz saxophone player that ever lived!
What are you getting so crazy about? It's just music. It's not that big a deal.
It is. Don't you understand? This is important to me.
Shrevey, why do you yell at me?
There's some plot machinery in Diner. I'd frankly forgotten about that. A couple of things really kind of are closer in spirit to something like Fast Times at Ridgemont High the same year, or even a lot lower down the chain, Porky's, where you have a couple of like sexual shenanigans, slapstick things that are a little like, but even those are handled so well by Levinson, and they mm-hmm. they keep it kind of in the real world. And it's I remember seeing it and we're thinking, you know, this movie could go on another hour for me. Yeah, very good. Don't need much plot. Great reminder, I think. You know, if you have the right people and you can just, it's like the old Chekhov rule. How do I keep these people in a room talking?
Mm-hmm.
That's all you need. That's as much plot as I need.
Yeah, I needed to see Diner for this list. It was one of my blind spots.
What'd you think?
I remedied that, just watched it about a week ago, and I really loved it.
You did,
actually,
yeah.
Michael, I did. I think it's in, my number 9 or 10 of that year.
Right.
So it didn't make the top 5 cut, but really good. For all the reasons you said, those performances, I think the direction by Levinson is really assured, very smart, and there are certain elements you touched on where I thought it was maybe going to go a step too far, and then it reins it back in, and you're right, certainly, about Mickey Rourke in that film as well. So
wonderful. Breaks your
Diner's
heart.
Good. I have a question about Kevin Bacon and his character.
Fenwick.
I'd like to pose to you. Fenwick. I'll pose it off-air.
Well,
we
off
can
air.
Discuss that.
Okay, well, off-air. Okay. Bonus content or completely off-air?
No, completely off-air. No one's going to hear this conversation.
Will Josh hear it?
No.
Do I have to go home?
Yeah, no. Josh can't listen. Okay, so we are in the home stretch. We have 3 more picks. These 3 movies do make at least 2 of our lists. Josh, you're going to do the honors with this choice.
So Fitzcarraldo.
Yeah.
I ended up seeing for the first time.
I'm so glad.
Like you, Adam, did a little homework for this. And, of course, Werner Herzog's film about the turn-of-the-century entrepreneur in Peru who portages a steamship from one tributary to another in the Amazon. That's what I'm looking for, right? That section. And it's amazing. it's everything lives up to what I expected, even knowing that it was coming. I love the long shots that Herzog uses to really emphasize the immensity of this undertaking, and even that one aerial shot that gives us a sense of what they're trying to pull off. And when Fitzcarraldo, Klaus Kinski, does that jump for joy when it starts inching forward, you're there for him, even though
he's a lunatic,
he is
who's endangered the lives
out of his mind
of
and
many
making
people.
Everyone suffer for maybe not his art that he's creating, but his love of art. So right. I love the tension.
Which is also the process
character.
Of working with Kinski.
Yes, and the process of Herzog making this film.
Right.
So all of the levels at play here, which are right there on the screen, makes this just immensely fascinating to watch and to think about. But I also like the little touches, Adam, which obviously don't get talked about as much, but scenes that some of them are maybe bigger when they start chugging down this river and they hear those drums coming from the woods, and Fitzcarraldo responds by bringing his record player to the roof of the steamship and blasting Caruso back at them.
Now it's Caruso's turn.
Just this wonderful moment of artistic antagonism that ends up for a while working out for him. But then also smaller touches like the scene where this tribe that he enlists to work for him, when they start to turn, and that moment where they slowly leave the lit circle from his kerosene lamp and their faces disappear into the darkness and then their hands disappear. There are a lot of really beautiful filmmaking touches in Fitzcarraldo that, yeah, a shame it took me this long to see it.
I thought about that last scene when I saw the James Gray film, The Lost City of
Sure.
Me, which actually has a lot of, you know,
absolutely.
A huge debt to it.
Yes. No, that's a great point.
If you guys haven't seen it and you're really into Fitzcarraldo, check out The Less Blank.
Yeah, Burden of Dreams.
Burden of Dreams.
I was going to say.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, Fitzcarraldo is my number five film of 82. And if you have any doubt how remarkable it is, the movie about the making of the movie is arguably just as good. It really is.
It's just, the other side of the megalomania that Herzog's exploring through Fitzcarraldo, the character.
So
You're seeing it in Herzog.
Self-portrait, which, yes, you can detect in Fitzcarraldo, the film itself. And I think Sam pointed out, didn't he, that Ebert had these as one and two.
Yeah,
right?
I think you almost have to combine them. They're such a set, obviously, and they're both fantastic, as I said. But Kinski's performances, too, are something that over the years, as I see them again, and I recently, in the past 3 years or so, watched Aguirre, The Wrath of God again, you think of them as so big, as so larger than life.
This
and then
isn't
you realize,
really.
No, you realize that even though Fitzcarraldo is a charismatic presence, certainly has a lot of passion, and I suppose you wouldn't call him too subdued, Kinski manages, despite being kind of a monster, brings this immense humanity to all of these roles and is believable despite often being totally insane, playing characters who are totally insane while at the same time probably being insane. Herzog would certainly argue he was.
I think it was the same year. Did you ever see Venom? The killer snake on the loose in a Flat in London movie. So this is Kinski in an English language role, and it's one of the worst films of the year. And this is terrible to make fun of dialect humor. You know, it's not supposed to be funny at all. But there's some line where Susan George, who's in it, is something about like, well, you know, we've got to think, and he says, "Sink? I will tell you what to sink." And it's like sink. You know, and the movie's already sunk by then. But anyway, check out Venom. Well, actually never check out Venom.
Someday we'll get to it.
You almost sold me.
The thing about Kinski as Fitzcarraldo is he's pitiable in a lot of these scenes and clownish. There's that opening section where he's trying to sell his fellow businessmen on his plans and at a party, and it goes disastrously wrong, and then people are laughing at him. So, yeah, that was a surprise too, Adam, is I had Aguirre in my mind, much, much bigger.
Yeah.
In that film, and got something, you know, along the same thematic lines, but performance-wise, very different.
Well, let's get to another choice here that is a joint pick. And Michael, it's your number one. And you know what? I think it really would have been better served maybe by Kinski playing the lead role.
Tootsie.
Can you imagine Tootsie that would have with
been
Kinski?
That would have been just a pleasure. No, I love Tootsie. And I was reading up on Tootsie, both some critics at the time and a lot of critics since then. I didn't really realize how many people really don't like it at all.
Huh.
Find the sexual politics kind of smug and even, you know, kind of retrograde and condescending. Just don't really like any of the, quote, messaging in what Michael Dorsey, the actor played by Dustin Hoffman, who, you know, dresses in drag and suddenly becomes, as he says, you know, throughout the picture, at the end of the picture, he says, I was a better man as a woman than
right.
I was the end of it. That's the line that I think is the thesis line I wish wasn't in
yeah.
the movie. There's a lot of things that aren't great about the film. If you look at it as an artifact of 1982, there's, first of all, you got to put up with one, you know, that horrible song.
The montage?
The horrible song.
Come on,
was
everybody
not,
sing it.
I couldn't, no.
Go, Tootsie,
no,
go.
No, not that one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No,
I mean,
I'm talking
you're
about
right, the other hit.
The bucolic one.
Yeah.
You know, the lyric interlude.
Something's telling me it might be you. It's telling me it might be you.
Very TV-ish.
Yeah, awful. When I was 21, you couldn't get that thing off the radio. But I think that Sidney Pollack's direction, the screenplay, which shouldn't work at all, but it was written by something like literally 14 or 16 different people. It was just a flip of the coin who got credit from the WGA. Larry Gelbart, Murray Siskel, Elaine May. I think Adam worked on it for a time. Josh's parents. Everybody worked on
my
it.
My first writing assignment in school.
Yeah.
But that film completely rolls with an audience. I've never seen an audience. When I think of the movie that gave me the most pleasure at the time and still gives me the most laughs now, if you just look, you know, and I favor comedies because they're typically disfavored, but mm-hmm. Bill Murray, it was amazing to see Bill Murray kind of in a role that absolutely, for better or for worse, mainstreamed his appeal, you know, and he improvised half his scenes anyway. But, you know, he's wonderful as the playwright friend, is kind of just this deadpan foil.
Have you mentioned Terry Garr yet?
Terry Garr, great.
Oh, so good.
George Gaines,
amazing.
You know, unbelievable.
George Gaines too.
I love it. I love it.
I did have a good time. I really did, Mike.
Oh, you did? Wait,
yes,
I didn't bring enough money for camp.
That's okay. It's cheaper to get mugged. Let's walk.
Sure.
The fares are really insane now anyway.
Why didn't you have a good time?
I did have a good time.
What's wrong?
Nothing's wrong.
What? What?
Nothing. I'm nothing. I'm perfectly fine. I just cry like this, like a tick.
Will you tell me what's wrong or I'll kill you?
Nothing's wrong, Michael. I'm really very up.
You're worried about your audition tomorrow, aren't you?
No, I'm not worried about that audition.
Why?
Because
why
I'm not
going to
get it. I'm not going to get it. Because I'm completely wrong for it.
Why? What kind of a part is it?
A woman!
So that was my other bit of homework. I had to watch Tootsie, and I really liked it. Not as much as you guys, because Josh, you have it high on your list as well.
Yeah, I've got it. Well, I've got it at number four, and here's my hesitation about it, I guess. It speaks to what you're saying, Michael. I'd be curious if a lot of this criticism you've picked up on does tend to be more looking at it in the last 5 to 10 years or so, because I was leery mm-hmm. of putting it, wondering, surely the gender politics in this thing are not going to hold up to today's microscope. You seem to hint that there may be things
it's a little bit feminism for dummies, you
yeah.
know?
And exactly.
It's not even really great. It's not. It's kind of a dork's idea
but
of
I
feminism.
Don't, but. Well, okay, but I don't know. Is that entirely fair to the movie? If we're looking at this as a top five film of 82, putting these sorts of ideas out there in a mainstream huge hit that I think you have to give credit for a movie being ahead of its time, even if it's dated now, in a way, and maybe not ahead of its time, but for a mainstream film, again, ahead of mainstream Hollywood's
yeah,
now, time.
Yeah. Now,
and so I think there's a value in that, besides on top of the fact that it is so funny and does move with such great, except for those montages maybe, comic rhythm. I mean, Murray's delivery, and to see him ease into a little bit more of a character part. Terry Garr, I mean, I think we need to start saying the great Terry Garr.
Yeah.
We look every time she comes up in A Sacred Cow, whether it's Close Encounters mm-hmm. or Young Frankenstein.
And
you know,
our eventual Sacred Cow of Mr. Mom.
You, well,
no.
We'll get there eventually.
It's a detestable film.
Stop it.
It is.
Stop it. We were doing
gender
so
political.
Well.
You want to talk about gender politics
that
may do not survive?
A bit more.
Let's take this outside.
Okay. That's the phrase, Michael, that do not survive. I think Tootsies do survive, even though they may not stand up to today's standards, and, mm-hmm. and it, yeah. it's worthy because of
well,
that.
Well, one thing I don't really have much patience for, frankly, is people who and now it seems odd, but you can look at Tootsie as you know as very much a different era. Just like we all look at movies of the 30s and 40s as like a long time ago, right? Tootsie's its own kind of 80s artifact, but if you're really going to write that movie off. Because the sexual mores and the gender politics are antiquated, you can use that stick to beat up half of the great movies, commercial comedies, all dramas, everything that came out of Hollywood 20, 30 years earlier. If I have any un-PC bone in my body, it's that. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't see the value in that. Oh, Casablanca, it's not relatable behavior. Well, I don't know. Citizen Kane, it's not really, you know, he's not nice or, you know, mm-hmm. it's not, I don't get those arguments. They're just, they go about 3 inches for me and then
yeah.
they're done.
Yeah. No, I can see that. I think.
It's worth it. Okay, here's yeah. the thing. Tootsie is worth it. It was worth paying for the money at the time, and it's worth seeing the whole movie again just for the look Charles Durning oh, gives yeah. Dustin Hoffman when he comes into the bar at the end, and there's a beautifully judged 3-second sort of like uh-huh. double take, mm-hmm. and then he realizes that you know it's the woman who's actually a man who he proposed to.
Yeah.
And it's just that scene in the bar is the it's peak comic screen acting.
Yeah.
You can't get better than that.
Mm-hmm. I think. My biggest pet peeve with Tootsie is the entire Dorsey-Jessica Lange romance. Everything about that I wish was in another
stuff.
Movie.
The sincere stuff.
Yeah.
You don't like the sincere
no.
stuff. You're not a sincere man.
Well, no. I don't like... That is what feels most conventional to me.
I will say this.
That at the end of the day, the movie yeah. felt like it had to have its leading man hook up with the leading lady.
Yeah, agreed. I think even though Jessica Lange won an Oscar, supporting actress Oscar for Tootsie, I think... And she, you know, she does not have any trouble holding a close-up or just maintaining your interest and attention, you know, whoever you are. You know, she's just has that much going, I think, mm-hmm. just as a charismatic performer. But she, I don't know if she always gets the tone of the movie because she plays everything very, very much for, you know, earnest, serious.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't play into the comedy
right.
at all.
She's doing her own thing.
And that's better. Yeah. That's a better instinct than playing too much into the comedy because there's enough mm-hmm. comedy in that movie. But that the performance is a little calculated. I mean, not in calculating, but just it's a little studious.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. That brings us to our final selection here. The movie that is number one on Josh's list, number two on my list, and basically the movie that proves that Michael has no heart.
You really don't have a problem with E.T., the extraterrestrial.
Is that how it's pronounced? I thought it was et.
Well, see, now you like
it.
Now you like
it. I thought it was just some weird, bad translation from another language.
I am glad that we cleared this up, Michael. So watch this.
You did rewatch it
with the
just
family.
Recently. I didn't get to.
Because, yeah, as I said a few shows ago, my kids did not immediately fall for this. They saw it under less than pristine conditions. They reminded me of this. I forgot. I didn't mention this, Adam, when I brought it up before. They watched the whole opening scene with just sound with Grandma and Grandpa. No visuals.
Why?
I don't know. This was a sleepover. Like I said, they couldn't get the thing going.
VCR to work? The DVD player?
I don't know.
Was it like a radio experiment?
I'm a little frustrated that...
I flash back to 82 there.
This is why we watched it again. I wanted prime viewing conditions for them. And, you know, they liked it a little bit more.
Just a little bit
just
more.
Just a little bit more. But, what they won't admit is, you know, they're really traumatized by that whole illness section, which goes on for a long time.
Well, you know, that's the thing about Spielberg. He is ruthlessly manipulative, and it's wonderful when it works. I like E.T. a lot, guys.
Okay, good.
So don't, you know.
Top 10? Top 10?
Not quite.
Oh.
Not quite.
82 right. must have been a good year.
Well, Porky's.
Yeah.
Here's what I've been noticing about Spielberg stuff as I'm revisiting it as an adult. Obviously saw E.T. in 82 and obviously loved it right up. I mean, it was like, aside from the alien me on screen, right? You're flying around with your friends on bikes. It's
right.
your first taste of freedom.
Flying?
Oh, man, we jumped.
Uh-huh.
We had ramps and everything at them, right?
Yeah.
The BMX, it took off.
Nice.
So this was made for me.
Mm-hmm.
But as an adult, I'm starting to recognize this is in Close Encounters. This is in Jaws. That, and it's in Poltergeist, the heart of these movies are the authentic, deeply felt families that are being portrayed. And the amount of time we spend with them, the way we get to feel what's in their rooms, what the production design of these, you know, you think of Spielberg as this fantasy director, but it's the production design of these kids' rooms that matters. The toys they play with, the clothes they wear. That's why the fantastic works for us in a Spielberg film, because we know the families so well. The mundane has become so familiar. And when those two things meet, it creates this vortex of magic that really does hold up. And think about this family in this film. You've got the recently surprised, you get the sense, surprisingly single mother, separated from the husband, played by Dee Wallace, who is note perfect in this movie as a harried mom just trying to keep it together, with these three kids who are feeling their independence but also feeling their mom's sorrow. You sense that in every scene, played by Robert McNaughton, Henry Thomas, and, of course, Drew Barrymore.
What are you going as for Halloween?
I'm not going to stupid Halloween.
Why don't you go as a goblin?
Shut up.
It's not that we don't believe you, honey.
Well, it was real, I swear!
What are you going as, Gert?
I'm going as a cowgirl.
So, what else is new?
Maybe it was an iguana.
It was no iguana.
Maybe a... you know how they say there are alligators in the sewers?
Alligators in the sewers.
All we're trying to say is maybe you just probably imagined it.
I couldn't have imagined it.
Maybe it was a pervert or deformed kid or something.
A deformed kid.
Maybe an elf or a leprechaun.
It was nothing like that, penis breath!
Elliot! Sit down.
Because their life together as this family going through this transition right now is so authentic and it's so true, that's why we buy E.T.'s entry into it. And that's why I think it moves us. It's not, those scenes are not perfunctory. They're essential. And it happens with all of Spielberg's really strong films. When he doesn't entirely pull it off, say War of the Worlds, I think that's why maybe it doesn't hit as hard.
That's a good point.
And that's why I put E.T. up there as top tier Spielberg, with Close Encounters, with Jaws, probably with AI, artificial intelligence, very different movie, but those are my top
ones.
And
I agree. I think it is top tier Spielberg. So like why did it make my top five? I mean, just missed it.
Okay.
Well, you had to make room for Wrath of Khan. I mean, that's
he did
completely understandable.
Look, at the time, I just you know what? Honestly, my E.T.
Phillips,
my E.T. reaction, you know, very much liking but not loving. It was the almost the opposite of Close Encounters, which you know, which I saw earlier when I was in high school. But that film I saw 6-7 times. I thought the last 30 minutes. I still think the last, and I've said it here on the show, last 30 minutes of Close Encounters, that's the Spielberg for the ages.
Yeah.
Everything about it.
You might be right on that, Michael Phillips.
There's no might about it.
No, I love Close Encounters.
Yeah, I know. I'm just plain right.
Those are our top five films of 1982, and we're not done. We're gonna just really amp it up here with E.T. We're going to do something that listeners have been clamoring for a while now, ever since we started to use the E.T. music as our music that anoints movies. It officially transitions movies into the pantheon.
Yes.
But E.T. isn't in the film spotting pantheon.
We chose music from a movie that wasn't in the pantheon.
Now it is, Michael.
I'll be right here.
Goes back to the home.
There it is. There it is, right where E.T. belongs. We are happy to put it in the pantheon.
Can we whip through any honorable mentions?
Yes, let's please do honorable mentions. Michael, what do you have?
I'll give them to you. Just, you know, and not just because the show's been devoted to it. Blade Runner, okay?
Okay.
E.T.
Thank you.
48 Hours, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. My Favorite Year, which is not, I don't think, a great film in terms of craft, but
it is not.
It's... But it's
I just
really,
watched it.
But it's really funny, I think. It's
okay.
Worth it just for the moment where Lainey Kazan, you know, is just calling Peter O'Toole's character, Alan Swan, calls him Swanee.
Yeah.
And just,
you're right.
Just
that's a good scene.
And then Mark Lynn Baker says,
I'll give you that.
He's an actor,
a good
not
scene.
A river.
10 minutes of good acting. It's on Michael's top 10 list.
You know, but this does actually, this betrays my penchant for comedy. You know, I'll forgive anything if I get three laughs out of anything. The Night of the Shooting Stars is one of the
don't
great,
know that one.
From the Taviani brothers, Italian film set at the very end of World War II. Really, really good film. The Return of Martin Guerre, a French film. with Gerard Depardieu and Natalia Baye. Check that out. The Draftsman's Contract, my favorite Peter Greenaway film still. The Gray Fox, check that out. Richard
Farnsworth,
with wonderful characters set in the early, you know, it's an old cowpoke who sort of accidentally discovers the early silent film industry. And then I guess I'd throw in Poltergeist, too. That's my number 10.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
And I never saw Poltergeist all the way through until last week.
No kidding.
Yep. And I do think it's a fascinating bookend. I mean, really a straight bookend to E.T. It's like it was shot and set and conceived one neighborhood over.
Yeah.
You know? Exactly. Yeah. Josh.
So my 6 through 10 would probably include The Dark Crystal. I watched it recently.
Watch, so this is the movie
I currently have at the bottom of this list.
I believe
at
it.
At the very bottom.
I absolutely believe it. This is a movie you should not even be allowed to watch.
It's behind
it
Six
is.
Pack.
It is.
Kenny Rogers starred in that movie, Josh.
Oh, Adam. Adam. Dark Crystal, masterpiece of world building. We've been talking about world building.
Well, I haven't seen it since I was seven.
Also, another top five terrifying character.
Yeah, maybe.
The Skeksis. Tron. How about Tron? I think Tron. Okay,
Tron.
So Tron is a weird
four
movie
from the bottom.
Because, yes, in many ways, it belongs there. But it also has these abstract expressionist elements to it that Fritz Lang's Metropolis gone disco. That's the positive take.
Roller disco.
On Tron. Roller disco. You got it. An Evening with Robin Williams probably doesn't count, you know, TV special, but we revisited
HBO.
That when
oh, yeah.
he passed, and oh, it's so
it's
good.
Funny.
And here's one, White Dog. Always wanted to see
Ooh,
White
Sam
Dog,
Fuller.
The Sam Trouble. Fuller picture. So I watched it for this list, not knowing what I would get. This is where a trainer tries to deprogram a dog that's been taught to attack black people. It was very strident, very PSA about racism. But you've got Fuller's bracing in your face style going on at the same time that makes this really vicious and disturbing. I don't know, Michael, do you have a take on
it's good.
White
I haven't
Dog?
Seen it in a long time. And I actually, because the release was so kind of haphazard and delayed.
Oh, yeah, like years
yeah.
later in the U.S.
It, you know, absolutely in line, though, with the, you know, he was always a blunt. You know, I wouldn't say ham-fisted, but more just a blunt, you know, in your face. Kind of,
yeah.
You love that kind of allegory. And it's not one of my favorite Fullers, but it's a really interesting late one.
Yeah, definitely worth checking out. And then just real quickly here, Diner, I'm with you, Michael. Fast Times at Ridgemont High. These are the ones fighting to get into this
mm-hmm.
top
yep,
10.
Yep.
And here's one, Rambo First Blood, I think is a completely different film than the other Rambo pictures and a really interesting one.
Okay, so now you guys have officially crossed off here between your list and your honorable mentions, all of my honorable mentions except for two. I'll say the others real quick. 48 Hours, Fast Times, Officer and a Gentleman, Poltergeist, Diner, First Blood, Rambo. I thought it was going to go unmentioned. I really like that film. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. The two that have not come up. Sophie's Choice, which I will always appreciate. Pakula, great director. I'll always appreciate it because of Meryl Streep's performance and because of my love for the book. It's nowhere close to as good as the book, but few movies are as good as that William Styron novel. And Veronica Voss. A Fossbinder film set in the 1950s about a former German film star. Very good film. And that closes out our top five films of 1982. We would love to hear your picks or any other comments about the show. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
That's also where you can find 12 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives. That's all in the show archives. While you're at filmspotting.net, go ahead and vote in the current film spotting poll. We're asking, what is Darren Aronofsky's best film? The Requiem for a Dream and Black Swan director's new one, Mother, comes out in a couple of weeks.
That was emphatic.
That was good.
I'll give you that.
Also, if you haven't already, please do check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show, and Film Spotting SVU. You'll find them in Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your other podcasts.
Out in wide release this weekend, a re-release on its 40th anniversary, a movie Michael just might think you need to go and see. He mentioned it more times this show than Blade Runner, which we reviewed in some detail. Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Also, a Sacred Cow discussion here on the show. I believe, was Lincoln, what year was Lincoln?
2012.
Was it 2012 that long ago?
Could
it
be.
Can't be.
Yeah, I think so.
Wow, I think it was 2012. That just seems so weird to me. But on that show, we also discuss Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and we will link to that in our show notes if you want to hear that conversation. Out in limited release, Beach Rats, this is getting some good buzz. A film from emerging director Eliza Hittman. It came out of Sundance. Our friend Scott Tobias from The Next Picture Show gave it a positive review over at NPR.com. Tulip Fever. A 17th century set romance with one of my faves, Alicia Vikander and Dane DeHaan. It was completed in 2014, long delayed. They pushed it back and back. And now it's finally hitting theaters.
No screening.
No screening for critics.
They're going to dump it in the theaters Friday. Right. But they're going to dump it in the theaters on Friday.
They are indeed. So next week on the show, we're going to discuss It, the Stephen King adaptation, and share our top five Stephen King movie scares. It does open next weekend. And if you've got a movie scare that's one of your favorite from a King adaptation, send us an MP3 file, feedback@filmspotting.net, or leave us a short voicemail. We may just use it on next week's show, 312-264-0744.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Jeremy Wellhausen. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. And of course, Michael, thank you for joining us once again, bringing a handful of 82 titles that neither of us would have brought to the list, so we appreciate that.
And also even, causing some nice splits.
I never even got to Q or Swamp Thing. Have you seen
that's
either
true.
Q or...
Oh, Swamp Thing. Yeah. Yeah, it's on my full list of films of 1982, around 35, which I will link to. I am going to post my whole list of the films I've seen at Letterboxd. I'll link to it in
Slick.
Our show notes.
Good. No, thanks, guys.
Swamp Thing,
fun.
I've seen it. And Michael, you did, as we said, some writing about 82. We'll link to that in our show notes. Anything
nice.
Else you want to direct people to?
No, just the Twitter, of mm-hmm. course, at Phillips Tribune. And you can find the reviews and other things at chicagotribune.com/movies.
All right. Thanks again, Michael.
Thank you, guys.
For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
What were we using back then? Well, were you guys even alive? How old are you?
No? Yeah.
Seven.
You were
seven.
Eight?
I was eight.
Okay.
So when did we get our first computer? It was after that.
Yeah. The first time I used it on the – well, no, we used them on the first job, which was in 85, but they were terrible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Nobody had them at home. It was just mainframe. Yeah.
We had it. My mom was an early adopter. We had an Apple IIe in the mid-80s.
Okay.
Wow.
86, 87, somewhere around there.
In Iowa?
In
I'm
Iowa.
Just kidding. Says the
true story.
Never seen. And very gospel.
We'd go to the pizza ranch, Josh, and yeah. borrow their apple.
Yeah.
And
there's a ranch for pizza.
There is. It's like his favorite restaurant.
I was
in Iowa.
So tempted to go. Where was I? Michigan.
Do they film spaghetti westerns on that ranch?
They could.
I almost went in.
You almost went because there was one.
Almost
in.
Went in.
Yeah.
They must be expanding. It's catching on. It's taken 30 years, but.
Uh-huh.
The Pizza Ranch concept.
Pizza Ranch.
What is it? It is like a buffet, right?
Headquarters, Orange City, Iowa, baby.
It can't lose. It's a surefire concept as cowboys and aliens.
It's there.
You got it?
Yes.
Oh, praise the Lord.
Yes.
So here we go.
Okay,
Josh,
yeah.
Wait a second. I'll have you know, Wisconsin, 18 locations.
Okay.
North Dakota, 14. There's 42 Pizza Ranches in Minnesota.
What? How many in Illinois?
Seven.
Yikes.
And there are 22 in South Dakota, but the hub.
What kind of pizza is that? Sort of
Iowa, 76.
Jesus. Is it like that indistinct medium crust? Like it's not, we're not
yes.
really thin.
Yes.
It's a buffet
really...
place, right?
Yeah, it's mostly a buffet place. It's really not that bad.
Is one of like a million options.
You can drive to Peoria, Josh, okay. or Springfield and get your Pizza Ranch fix.
One desperate, very desperate day, I will eat at a pizza ranch.
If there was
ranch.
A pizza ranch when Lincoln was alive,
yeah.
he would have been like William Howard Taft.
True.
Right? I mean, okay.
Irresistible. Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.